Hi, welcome to Yours, Mine, and Theirs, a podcast about movies and democracy. My name is John, and I'm full of grace and vinegar. Who else is here?
Hi, I'm Roy, and you can't tell me what to do unless you're telling me to huff right guard. Then you can tell me what to do.
I'm Melissa, and I care not what John's expectations of me are.
Excellent. Way to set it up. You've perfectly positioned yourself. Kudos on that fine power move there, Melissa. Okay, Melissa Martinez is joining us for the first time. She is obviously a very regular person on the Kiss Your Franchise Goodbye podcast.
Can I ask about that? Andy's in charge of it, but is everyone except for Andy a rotating guest? Or
no, it's me, Brooke, and JB, and I think now his sister Kit.
You're full-timers.
Yeah, we're all
like full-timers. Every single podcast.
I'm the returning champ every week. And I almost got a championship belt out of it.
I thought they gave you the belt.
Style. No, because he threatened to make us, because on that podcast, I don't know if you do that here, but you get to pick a movie for your birthday. And my birthday movie I picked is actually one of the ones we're going to discuss today. He picked for his birthday, or he was going to pick this movie I did not want to see called like RRR or something.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I was like, oh, hell no, I don't want to see this damn movie. So he ended up picking instead Everything Everywhere All at Once. And so The bet was I would get a championship belt if I hated the movie after whatever his birthday movie was. But that's a great movie. Of course I didn't hate it, so I didn't get my championship
belt. That's a weird way to earn a belt.
I could have lied. I could have lied, but, you know, I'm nothing if not honest.
Is it like a Clubber Lang belt? I've never heard of a belt of hatred.
I don't know. I'm the returning champion every week, though. I was a guest. I started out as a guest, and now I'm a regular.
That's awesome. So you guys are deep into Disney princesses. Is that still an unresolved franchise?
We do Frozen 2 tomorrow.
Okay. So I sign up for some of those, and then I see Andy post them, which is always fascinating to me.
Which is about the same as me with this podcast.
I guess. Oh, okay. Yeah, evening the scales here. Okay, I hope the universe is more all right after we're done here, and we can get all that sorted and figured out. Roy, I don't know if I need your Disney princess opinions myself. I mean, I get it all the time.
That's all we talk about.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I want to go back. Melissa, I'm surprised. Why is your mind just not open to RRR?
Look, I'm a woman, okay? Uh-huh. I deal with brosives all day, uh-huh. You know? And this looks like a brosive movie. Do you understand
right,
what I'm
right,
saying?
Right, like, yeah.
It's like if a bunch of frat boys got together and said, what if we did all this stuff but made it in India? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's like a typical frat boy movie, but the only difference is that it's, you know, it reminds me of, like, the Snyderverse, right? Like,
right.
You have all these frat boy wet dreams, but then somebody was stupid enough to give them money to do it.
Mm. Okay.
And that's what it looks like to me.
So I almost hate Fight Club because I don't know if it meant to be a bro movie, but it's been co-opted by the bros.
Right.
Oh,
right.
Big time. Yeah.
Sure. I'm wondering just because, I mean, okay, this is a huge blanket statement. I mean, obviously it's like, You had such great success with another Indian movie that I know is dear to your heart. So I'm just,
I don't know.
Okay. And I'm just talking just because I've heard RRR is really good. I don't know anything about it. Mm-hmm. All I know is it's long and it's really wacky in a similar way. Everything Everywhere All at Once is. And so I can't defend it because I haven't seen it and I don't know anything about it. But I'm just wondering, I mean, do you think maybe it's possible that it's like a another gem that you have yet to discover?
Possibly. I mean, I'm open to that possibility, but you know, and if he had chosen that as his birthday movie, I would have watched it for the podcast. And maybe who knows, maybe I would have liked it. You know, like, I generally don't like mob movies or war movies.
Right.
Because they're just, like, so full of just, like, toxic masculinity. Not to use buzzwords, but that's what they are a lot of times, especially the mafia movies. But every once in a while, there's one I'm like, hey, that was pretty good, you know? Like,
right.
You know, so, I try to keep an open mind.
I mean, I understand.
I choose it myself.
I feel like there's a lot of action and violence in RRR, even though I don't know anything about it. So it's got an uphill climb, like you said, yeah.
It just looks like fanfic to me, you know?
I was pretty resistant to Barfy when you picked it, and I think the movie poster didn't help. but we'll get it. And actually, Barfy is not the first Indian movie we've done. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you are a fan of classic Indian film, but we did The World of Apu, which is just one of my very favorites.
Yeah.
I have not seen that.
That's one of Roy's very favorites. It's one of those, like, he convinced me. I was like, this is the one I don't want to watch, you know, when Roy made me watch it. But but it is, it's a pretty, what years? It's like it's a really gorgeous, like, 50s movie.
50s. Yeah.
And one thing, actually, you know, and this is weird. I kind of hate that we're just, like, lumping Indian cinema all together in these movies. But, you know, I don't know. It just kind of one thing about World of Apu that you kind of don't get a gist of. Like, when you see, like, Indian movies today, you think, like, these vivid colors and, you know, the vibrance on the screen. World of Apu is this tremendous looking black and white movie. Like, it's sort of unusual as a Westerner who's only seen, you know, half a dozen Indian films to, like, see something in black and white and kind of see it like it's like a different type of Indian beauty that you're not as, you know, you're just not as used to seeing, because, you know, all the new Indian flicks that you see are just so, like, just very colorful, you know, and it's really pretty black and white. I like it a lot.
Yeah, it's lovely. So I guess so. You're kind of taking us on a whirlwind adventure of international cinema and also Citizen Ruth.
Really quickly, actually, I'm curious. Like, do you have a quick story about each of these? Like, were they just formative at a time? Do you remember seeing them for the first time, or how you came across them?
So Citizen Ruth, I came across, I used to date this guy who was kind of a cinephile, or at least he fancied himself one. And he was a fan of Alexander Payne, who's the director. Mm-hmm. And I love Laura Dern. I think she's amazing, and she's an amazing actress. And so I was willing to watch it. I didn't see it right when it came out, but maybe a few years later. And I remember the reason why it stuck in my head is not only because, you know, Laura Dern, and it was just really good. Also, I hate Burt Reynolds and he's in it, but he was tolerable even in this, you know.
Right.
And anybody who wants to hear me rant about him, because I won't put y'all through that here. But we on the other podcast, Kiss Your Franchise Goodbye, the one where I'm the returning champ. We did Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, and he is very prominent in that movie. He's one of the top two billed stars. Whereas in this, he's more of like a sideshow. But yeah, so if you want to hear that rant, you can go listen to that episode. But it came out at a time, because I'm 45 years old. So when this came out, I was like graduated from high school and like trying to figure things out, you know?
Yeah.
And I was somewhat apolitical because I think the nasty discourse we have now between the two sides was just beginning back then. And this movie sort of proved to me that both sides are full of it, you know? And look, I'm not going to try and get political here. I don't want to do that. I don't want to turn that into this, you know, that kind of podcast, but I definitely side with one side of the abortion debate.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that I don't think their leaders are full of it, too. You know what I'm saying? Like, and this movie kind of showed how both sides are just like we're using Ruth, and it stuck with me, you know, and look at what's happening. And look, I made the decision to do this movie when you guys first told me I was coming on back in the spring. And now with the recent Supreme Court decision, it seems like very timely to be watching it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, so
I thought this movie was mostly about the pro and anti huffing camp.
I remember in your comments on the Facebook page, you said, "Oh, that's how you huff paint or something like that." I was like, "He lives in a bubble. He
doesn't." I've never seen anyone huff before. I just like, do you just like smell it as it's coming out? I don't know, but there you go. Now I know I've got the tools and I can huff away.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If nothing else, if we've learned nothing else, it's how to get really huffed.
Okay. On the cheap, because I don't think that stuff's very expensive. But
yeah.
Okay. The next movie you picked, Maria Full of Grace. I remember that was a Sundance darling, but I never saw it until now.
So this movie, by the way, it's a – I feel like we should kind of say this. It's a Colombian film, but they wouldn't let Colombia submit it for the Academy Awards because it was filmed in Ecuador or something weird like that.
Mm. Oh, but I didn't anyway, know that.
Yeah, I did not either.
Huh. Okay, did you see it when it came out?
I did. With this one, I was struck because I grew up in a house. I'm third generation of Americans. My family is from Mexico originally. And, you know, growing up, we were rather invisible. Like, Chicanos like us, we were just very invisible. Like, you know, come out, mow our lawns, raise our kids, make our dinner, but then go back to, you know, the barrio, right? And so my grandparents were kind of raised us to be that way, too. Like, we're kind of judgmental about poor people or whatever. We were middle class. And so we didn't have a lot of money, but we made ends meet at least. When I saw this movie, it kind of brought back what my family who stayed in Mexico when they came to visit us would say, like, don't be so quick to judge. You don't know people's stories. You know, your grandparents are just trying to make you American, but you're Mexican American. And this movie sort of reminded me of that in a way, because I think people are quick to judge, like, drug mules and people who are involved with that kind of thing. But if you look at a real human story like this, I would hope it would make you think. You know, there's a lot of story behind why people make the decisions they do. You know, I'm sure there's a lot of people who, if you could get them to sit down and watch this movie, would be like, oh, she took drugs. Well, she swallowed drugs while she was pregnant and blah, 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 you know, and they would judge her and condemn her. But there's more to the story than that. And I just really love that idea. Plus, I like female centric movies because there aren't enough of them.
Yeah. Mm.
And I like ones that explore some kind of Latino culture, even if it's not my own, you know, but I just wanted to have that in there and show the human side. Also, I hate that, you know, when you see cartels portrayed in movies and TV, a lot of times it's very like, oh, jet setting and very, you know, like organized and almost glamorizing it.
Yeah.
And here you see the reality. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's just a bunch of, you know, people just trying to get by and there's not a lot of glitz or glam and there's nothing glamorous about it. They're not trying to glamorize it. They're just trying to tell a story to make you think twice and maybe not be so judgmental. So it really stuck with me. So that's why I chose that one. Okay. And also I figured there was a good chance y'all had never seen it.
No, thanks. It's totally true. It's one of those that I've heard a lot about. And I mean, I try to, this is a big Sundance favorite. And you know, I mean, hey, you make fun of me all the time and that's fine, but I'm a sheltered boy from Utah. But one thing I do is, you know, I head just around the corner to Sundance every year, and so I usually catch things. But this is like a Sundance movie that I missed for like 20 years, and so it's actually really perfect.
Yeah. So John isn't able to live or grow up in the hood, he, you know, Sundance is the next best thing. The Sundance Film Festival.
I try.
Is that the Utah version of the hood?
Yeah. Totally is.
The caviar there is just really, it's low quality. So
when you come and visit, you know, we'll do Sundance, we'll go skiing and you know, and I'll take you to some of my favorite restaurants.
Mexicans don't get on skis. We don't do cold.
All right.
We're tropical. We're tropical. No, really. I'm just a klutz, dude. If I tried to get on skis, I'd probably kill myself. I'd be like the nobody Sonny Bono or Bono or whatever, however you say a name, the one who ran into a tree or something. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
That would be me.
My brother once ran into a tree while skiing, just to see how well it would work. Yeah. He's okay. He's okay. Yeah. He just wanted to see, because, you know, they actually have like pads on some of the trees and like big pads on like the poles that have the ski lift.
The frequently hit trees.
He's like, I wonder how that pad feels. And he said, it didn't feel great, is what he told me.
This is, well, just imagine, this is from coming from someone who goes swimming with sharks and parasailing and scuba diving. I do all these things that are kind of risky. But skis is like somehow a bridge too far for me. I just can't, because I'd be shivering. And, you know, anything below like 72 degrees is freezing to me. I'm from South Texas. You know what I'm saying? So I can't imagine. But as long as there's a Kong cone involved, I've heard those are really great. So because I do a podcast with a bunch of other people from Utah. I can't escape Utah. My boss is from Utah. I can't escape it. So if you bribe me with a con cone, I'll do a bunny slope or something.
Okay. Yeah. I'll bribe you with what that thing you said.
Con cone. I have
King
no
Kong
idea.
Cone. Con cone. King it's Kong an cone. Ice cream cone.
Okay.
I trust you. Other Utans talk about it all the time.
Really? Yeah. Okay. No, I'll check that out. Yeah.
Is it Utans?
Utans.
How do you say that?
Utahans.
Tongs like kitchen tongs?
No, Utahans like whiskey or weird.
Okay. I would spell it Yoottonns. Utahans. Like that.
Utahans.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Speaking of getting out, Barfi. This is a movie. I actually just, I've been sitting on the Kiss Your Franchise Goodbye episode of Barfi for a long time because I had never seen Barfi, and so I listened to that today, and I was especially because I was very curious to, you know, because you're the only person I know who's like, hey, everybody watch this movie. And so from my understanding, you got the advice from the podcast, the Happy Time, the Smile Time podcast.
Pop Culture Happy Hour.
Pop Culture Happy Hour, I forgot, yeah.
It's an NPR podcast hosted by Linda Holmes, who's also a book author who I really like. She suggested this, and it's on Netflix, and I have Netflix, so I just decided, hey, let's try it. You know, one night, I couldn't sleep. I have insomnia really bad. That's why I watch so many movies. I generally like a lot of her suggestions, except that she's really into like romance novels. And hey, I'm not going to begrudge anybody some smut. You know, you do you. But I just hate the bodice ripping aspect of, you know, too much for me. But beyond that, I generally like her suggestions. And so I watched this movie and I just fell in love with it. And so I picked it for my birthday movie for Kiss Your Franchise Goodbye. And basically the main reason why I volunteered when y'all were asking for guests was that I want more people to watch this. I did not realize you only have 3 listeners, so, you know, I might not have volunteered. But, okay, at least the 2 of you watched it, so that's good.
There you go.
One person at a time, totally one person at a time. All right. Well, let's get into them a little bit of detail. Roy, see if you can tell us what happens in Citizen Ruth. I'm curious about how you're going to do this.
Oh, no problem. This is a pretty straightforward plot, right? So Ruth, I meant to do this quickly, but the opening credits are just so great, right? It's like this classy music and the titles and everything are so beautiful, and it looks like a highbrow rom-com, and then she's like enjoying the company of that meth head in the factory, right?
Yeah.
On his filthy mattress. So she is a drug addict. Her drug of choice is huffing anything she can get her hands on. We find out she's pregnant, and she gets arrested, which I just feel like a cop should have something better to do than arrest people for doing the drugs, right? But anyway, that's another conversation. So she goes before a judge, and the judge decides to charge her with endangering the life of her unborn child. She learns she's pregnant. And it's weird because you have that, and you contrast it with him saying, you're harming your unborn child, but also if you get an abortion, then the charges go away. So he's kind of like on both sides, right? Anyway, she is rescued from her plight by, what's the name of the group? I mean, it's the guy from RoboCop, but like the Lifesavers, yeah, or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I forget the name, but yeah.
It's like the Life Huggers.
The Life Huggers. They have like the what would you call that? The life buoy symbol. It looks like the embryo was inside it instead of the mother. And anyway, it's weird.
I was watching this with Katie, and she was like, that logo looks like a little Trump baby. Like, it's like Trump as a baby in an embryo in a buoy. Yeah. A lifesaver thing.
Yeah. So she's taken home by this super Christian-y group that is against abortion, and she's just kind of happy to have clothes and food and what are their names? I'm going to say Mr. Boddicker because he's from RoboCop, but the Stonies. Okay, so Mr. Stoney is a little creepy, right? Aside from being like also super evangelical, but I think and here's part of like the both sides are crazy, but I also think both sides mean well, even if they are crazy, right? She realizes quickly after she goes to the doctor and meets Dr. Hugh that they want her to keep the baby instead of having an abortion. She just wants to have the abortion because then she won't go to jail and she can get on with her life of huffing.
What does an abortion mean to you? It means I don't go to jail, yeah, or have to have another baby and I can get my life together. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But they show her a video and we don't get to see it, which is good. We get to hear a little bit of it. And after that, she is persuaded to keep the baby, but she goes out partying with the Stoney's daughter. I think they catch her huffing their son's modeling glue behind a store, and she punches the kid because he's trying to tell
she
on
punches
her.
The kid.
Yeah, and so
I wrote that. It's I mean, this movie's pretty complicated. It's kind of hard to, like, you know, you kind of have a little bit of sympathy for her, but I don't know, she does punch a kid.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, not because you keep waiting for her to, like, I don't know, make a smart choice or but she's pretty dumb. I think that's fairly clear. She does kind of look out for number one in the end, right? Like, she does kind of slip away from both sides. Anyway, the point is they don't want to take her back to her house because she punches kids, but their friend, who also is a crazy evangelical pro-lifer, says, well, I'll take her in, and she takes her to her house, and guess what? Not a pro-lifer, but a pro-choicer. And because all pro-choice women are gay, this girl is as well. So you've got that in their side, and they've got, I really like him. What's kind of their bodyguard? What's that guy's name?
Harlan.
Harlan. Yeah. Good old Harlan. He watches out for the place. And so the Christian group comes over to the house and tries to get her to come home. And she says she doesn't want to. She wants to have the abortion. And they have a vigil. And at one point, it's announced on the news that they have raised $15,000 to help her raise her baby. And then now she wants to have the baby because $15,000 is a lot. And she makes these plans. Apparently, she can buy a house and start a company and a lot of other things with $15,000. Was the economy that much cheaper 20 years ago? I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, that's left open. She,
is it just her naivete?
She thinks she can.
Yeah.
She thinks she can because the you know, the financial tape that she finds.
Oh, yeah. She's been listening to the financial tape from the Stonies. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, maybe she can't. You know, maybe I can if I bothered to listen to that kind of stuff. I don't, which explains the financial situation I'm in right now.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I'm sure she could do a lot with $15,000, though.
And you got to imagine, for someone like her, that's probably more money than she's ever had at once that she ever thought she'd have. So just that overwhelming feeling, it doesn't necessarily have to be that she can fulfill every dream with it. It's just having it, you know?
Well, yeah, 100%, right? It's $14,000 more than she's ever seen in her life, right? So Harlan pulls her back and promises that he will give her $15,000 to not have the baby. And so she's kind of persuaded to come back. But the Lifesavers, they pull out the big guns. What's his name? Blaine? Is it Blaine Gibson or something?
It's Blaine something. Yeah, I just wrote down
Gibbons.
Blaine Gibbons, yeah, played by Burt Reynolds. And Burt Reynolds has like an assistant named Eric who he saved from being aborted. And they have this weird relationship that involves back rubs.
Yeah.
And shirtless Burt Reynolds. But Burt Reynolds decides that they will now offer her $30,000. And then when she hears that on the news, she goes crazy again, and she's ready to take the money. And I think there's a great scene where there's a news crew filming from outside her house, and it says that she's been offered $30,000. What's she thinking? No one can say except for her. But it shows her like jumping up and down on the steps, screaming, excited for the money. But she's again persuaded to go to the clinic to have the abortion. But the morning of, she's bleeding, and so she has miscarried, and she hasn't told anyone yet. But she's miscarried, possibly because she's huffing a lot of drugs. Who's to say? I don't know. I've never been pregnant and done drugs at the same time. So
you've only been pregnant.
Yes. Very good. So she gets to the clinic because she knows Harlan has left her a bag for $15,000. And she takes that bag and she goes to the bathroom and she slips out the bathroom. And she tries to escape in a way where she isn't seen by anyone. And I think this is one of the crux of the movie, right? That she does escape simply by walking right past everybody. And they don't notice her, and I think it's because it has nothing to do with her, right? Like, she is what is being used for their purposes, and she's not really that important. So she walks away with the $15,000. Now, I don't think anyone imagines that she's going to turn her life around. Maybe she will. That'd be great. But she's probably about to go buy $15,000 of patio sealant.
I mean, I like to think she turns around, I was really, really surprised at how, I mean, the movie's very, very political. Like, it's the most political, but I was really surprised, you know, like halfway through the movie when it's like, oh, okay, you know, here are all the pro-choice people and, you know, how crazy they are, which, you know, isn't super crazy, but, you know, that turn really surprised me when Diane removed her wig. And I didn't notice it was a wig. Katie really notices a wig. She's like, I knew that was a wig. I'm like, oh, I just assumed she had that hair because she was that kind of person. But, yeah. I think the real political message, right, is, okay, hey, can we care about individuals? Can we look at that? Can we look at, you know, look at people like human beings instead of, you know, broad political swaths of things, you know, to be used? And I thought that was I really love that ending, you know, how she walked past everybody. Yep.
So I do love when the lady answers the phone to talk to the Stonies and she puts her glasses back on to get back into character. I think that there's some really great touches. There's that. There's the fact that she's wearing a Frida shirt while she's at their house. So apparently the tomb of the unborn baby is a real thing. I thought that was a joke, but it's not.
Oh, I thought it was a joke.
Nah, there is a tomb of the unborn baby, and it's not just a pro-lifer thing. It's like all children who were miscarried or whatever, right? But there is such a place. There's a tomb of the unborn baby. So I don't know. I hadn't an experience myself, not precisely with this, right? But where I was with a group that was being heavily protested, and I remember thinking that like the group that I completely disagreed with, I mean, they weren't like being paid to be there, and they weren't getting anything out of it, but they were sure dedicated. And all I could think was they really believe in what they're doing. And so there are people on both sides who go way too far, especially when it comes to like attacking facilities or threatening people, right? Which seems to happen a lot more from one side than the other. But I kind of feel that this is such a heated debate, and it's such a heated debate because I think both sides really, really believe that they're right, and everyone's got their opinion, and I've got mine. I think it's good to not demonize the other side as we tend to do, right? But anyway, you can have a crazy opinion, but please don't go, you know, bomb a building over it, please.
Yeah, maybe that's a bad idea.
Yeah. Anyway, this movie was fairly entertaining, and I don't know, this may be one of the earliest Laura Dern movies I've seen, although this has got to be pretty close to around
Jurassic Park,
right?
It was 3 years later, right? This is 1996.
This is 3 years after Jurassic Park. She looks so young in this movie.
Yeah.
Maybe it was the huffing. It takes years off you.
How method was she?
But I agree with you, John. So like the first half of the movie, I was like, okay, this is about how crazy pro-lifers are, right? And then she got to the pro-choice house, and I don't think they were as crazy. And I think politically that also tends to be the case. The pro-choicers aren't quite as crazy. But, you know, they also were pretty they had their problems too, right? So fascinating movie, and again, I love the ending where it just becomes really apparent that no one really cared about her. She cared about her, and she took care of herself.
You know, you said something really quick, kind of offhand, and it made me kind of rethink a little bit of the movie. You said, you know, one thing that Ruth does at the end is just she has a really look out for number one moment. And I kind of think I whenever I think of the phrase look out for number one, I think, OK, that's just very American. Yeah. You know, she was all these crazy, weird things. But the most American thing she did was take care of herself in a way. And so I'm like, OK, that's interesting. Okay, Melissa, I'm trying to figure out like what I can ask you because I know you have a lot to say about this. Maybe I should just let you jump in.
Well, I mean, I sort of explained some of it earlier when I was talking about why I chose this movie. And again, I chose it before the whole Supreme Court thing. And I actually thought about maybe changing it to something else, but I was like, nah. It's timely. I made the decision. And also, I just really want – I just love watching Laura Dern act, basically. But it – as a woman who, like I said, definitely sides more with one side than the other, it really made me think. And I got to say, as outrageous as they try to make, like, the media circus and everything seem – it's looked pretty damn realistic to me. Like this could happen.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? This, you could see something like this actually playing out in real time. And we have even more ways to disseminate information now than back in 1996. In 1996, the internet was in its infancy. I mean, America Online was like charged by the hour. You know what I mean? For dial-up service. Yeah. And nobody could afford that. You know, it was like $5 an hour. That was like more than minimum wage. You know what I mean? So it was just a different world. And so thinking about the media circus they had in 96 with such limited technology compared to today, imagine if the story of Ruth Stoop was on every cell phone and tablet and laptop, you know, from here to Timbuktu.
I'm trying to think of a parallel. Maybe like that 10-year-old girl from Indiana that there's been a bit of kind of a firestorm around.
Oh yeah,
that, right?
The one that had to travel to. No, she had. She's in Ohio, and she had to travel to Indiana.
It's Indiana, I think you're right, and because she was 10 years old, and she had been raped, and Ohio was not going to let her get that abortion, right? Which, by the way, I 100% agree with her getting that abortion.
Right.
So I think that might be sort of similar because I know that one side, so the pro-life side, some prominent news personalities doubted that the story was even true, right? That it was just being used as propaganda. Well, no, it was true. So I think maybe that is sort of similar to what this is, right? And I found it interesting that on, like, there were people who were supposed to be like good people, but also had like a little bit of creepy thing going on with them, right? Mm-hmm. Like Mr. Stoney, right, was checking her out, and maybe mm-hmm. would have made a move if she had responded. And then you had Burt Reynolds, who was super creepy. And then you have on the pro-choice side, well, they had the gall to be gay. So, I mean, geez. Right?
Shame on them.
Shame on them.
I kind of, if I may do a little bit of studio notes, sure. You know, to borrow from another. I kind of wish that the Kurtwood Smith character, I mean, I don't know how he couldn't be creepy because he's Kurtwood Smith. He looks like an insane creepy man. But I feel like they didn't have to have him be creepy and lecherous.
Like in the sexual way, you mean?
Yeah, in the sexual, like going after Ruth. Like he would have gone after Ruth. I think they went far enough with, you know, kind of with creepiness, you know, to not do that as well. And it's funny because I'm glad it's Alexander Payne. That's kind of the issue I had with Election as well. I was actually kind of surprised. When's the last time you guys saw Election?
I haven't seen it. I'm aware that it's the same person, and I think there was a point at which we may have almost watched it for one of our podcasts, but it didn't happen.
Right. Because the thing is, like, Matthew Broderick, I really liked Election because I related to Matthew Broderick as this, you know, kind of nerdy conservative guy who's afraid of change, and I really related to that.
Yeah.
And he was really intimidated by Reese Witherspoon's character, Tracy Flick. And to the point where he does some kind of despicable things.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, and I kind of liked that movie for that reason, because like, okay, you know what? I have problems because I'm relating to this person who's scared of change. And that's like a problem that I have. And, you know, that's like, you know, and it's like something that I have to overcome. But in the movie Election, they kind of stack the deck against Matthew Broderick because they also make him an adulterer in the movie to kind of just to make sure that we're not on his side. And I kind of thought the movie was more interesting when we're a little bit on his side because he's wrong, but you know, you kind of relate to him in finding Tracy Flick annoying, even though she's right. You know?
So with Mr. Boddicker, you're saying that if they leave that part out, then we can judge for ourselves.
We can judge for ourselves.
We don't need to be told that he's a bad guy.
Is only like 80% creepy instead of 130% creepy. Yeah, that's what I'm saying, I guess. Yeah. So, it's fine. It's a movie. Choices were made.
No, I agree with you on that though. I kind of wish they hadn't gone there because it does poison the well a little bit. And there's plenty of other things he did that you can, you know, judge him for or whatever. And also I think it's almost tropey at this point, praise Jesus, not Catholic, but because I was born and raised Catholic, but
just the fundamentalist Christian
who's the
secretly sexual hypocrite.
Right, who's or like the mistress who had the abortion even though he's anti-abortion. You know, they do these things in different iterations, but it's almost tropey at this point.
Yeah. Right, and I'm sure, like, I think if this were a real life story, I would be less surprised that they make that choice. But I think it would mean more, I think, to this particular story to just kind of put the needle just a little bit more to decent human being in just that one thing, and not, you know, so that we can make the judgments on all those other things and not just be like, oh, he's a bad guy.
Yeah.
Right.
Stop at that.
I want to say I like the character of Gail, right? Because I mean, you don't have to agree with her methods or her viewpoint, but Gail comes across as very sincere, right? And she's overbearing, right? And like, she has such a great line where it describes everything about her when she says, "Oh, we don't really sit in those chairs." And that's all you need to know about Gail, right? Such a good line. But I think like Diane, her character is also very sincere. And I think they're both fanatical for their side, but I can feel the sincerity, right? So anyway.
Yeah. Okay. Citizen Ruth. Those are all the tiny things that I wanted to mention. Does anybody have anything else about Citizen Ruth before we go on?
Oh, it's based on a true story.
Oh.
Did you know that?
Okay, that's crazy.
Melissa?
Yeah,
I did.
Yeah, based on a true story. And in the true story, the lady did end up having the abortion. But I can't remember the name of the person this was based off of, but it, same thing. Like, and I guess we can talk about that really quickly, right? Because there's a huge controversy over the whole idea of, like, harming an unborn child. And, like, because sometimes, like, someone will, like, a murderer kills a woman and also the unborn child. And do you charge him for the death of the unborn child? I mean, it seems like you'd want to, right? But then if you're doing that, are you admitting that it's a living separate being, right? And then what does that, you know, what does that do to the argument for, you know, pro-choice or whatever, right? So it becomes really, really hairy. And so for him to introduce that as like, I don't know if I'm setting precedents here, but right, like that is a really, really thorny issue because it seems
I wanted to go back on that thing you mentioned because it's something that, yeah, I haven't like totally worked my way around because it does make sense to me in a weird way where the judge says, okay, I'm going to charge you for endangering your unborn child.
Yeah.
But, you know, you should get an abortion.
Yeah.
Like, I know this like doesn't really make sense, but I mean, it also kind of makes sense. It's like, okay, you know, I think, you know, we're going to say abortion is okay. In certain cases, if it, you know, just, you know, for the sake of talking about this, it actually is more humane than if we're to say, okay, if there's some legitimacy to harming your unborn child through huffing or doing all these other things,
yeah.
It weirdly does make sense that, so, okay, you know what, this is a better option to go
and I think
rather than just like a torture of a kid, you know?
Yeah, and I think I understand that. Like if you intend to carry the baby to term and someone disrupts that or you like do something to cause problems, right, then maybe that makes sense. But as far as like
sorry.
Is that your cell phone's ringtone? I kind of love it.
Diane is calling.
Is there like a fire alarm going off? I don't know.
No, I'm sorry. That's my cell phone.
You're fine. I think that's separate from, I think the crux of it for me would be like, is there an intention to keep the baby? If so, then, you know, that choice has been made and it is a choice. And then harming the child, either an external actor or whatever, then makes sense, right? But I don't know. I'm no lawyer. Only two-thirds of one semester, so.
Yeah. Gosh. And I hate. Two-thirds of one semester. No. That's right. It does make sense in my mind, but it does open up. You know,
it's a can of worms.
Abuses around that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So.
And you know, because the West Wing is that TV show is a perfect example of what perfect politics should be like, and everyone thinks it's great, right? So that's not necessarily true, but there was an episode, right, where they were talking about hate crimes, which I agree with hate crimes, but the president didn't want to sign a bill on hate crimes because he didn't want to charge anyone. No one should be, like, punished for what they think, right? Like, for the intent behind the crime. And so I think, like, it's they're sticky issues. And it feels like, at a gut level, I feel like of course, being charged for hate crime is the right thing to do if it's an aggravating circumstance. Or the same thing with, of course, harming an unborn child while attacking the mother is the right thing to do. But they're sticky. They're sticky legal issues.
And it's actually kind of funny how my gut has changed over the years.
Much bigger.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe that's why it's changed. No, good call. And that's how I relate to pregnancy.
Oh, no.
Oh, man.
One little thing I want to say, that the judge in this movie was played by a man who was in a series of seminal movies from my childhood.
Oh, we know.
Police Academy.
Tackleberry.
That's Tackleberry.
Yeah.
Love it.
Definitely, for sure. It was strange to see Tackleberry.
Right?
Like, what are you doing? What's he doing?
I'm like, wow, Tackleberry's changed his views since he went to law school. Yeah. Now,
Tackleberry, he's not the one that ended up marrying the big buxom blonde girl in the fourth movie, was it?
Oh, gosh. Didn't he marry Colleen Camp in the fourth movie? Wasn't that Tackleberry's wife?
I don't remember. Was Colleen Camp like the tough, no-nonsense female cop?
No, that was Kim Cattrall, right? Cattrall. No, wait, that was just in the first one.
I have no idea. Okay.
Kim Cattrall got with Steve Guttenberg.
Well, yeah, why wouldn't you? That guy was a shooting star. His rocket was rising faster.
I had a crush on him in the 80s. I totally did. I'm not going to lie.
So there's a wonderful episode of The Simpsons that tells us that Steve Guttenberg is only a star because of the Stonecutters have propped him up.
Yeah. Yeah.
So. All right.
I miss Guttenberg. He was all right in Veronica Mars. Yeah, I guess I had no complaints about
Steve
Guttenberg.
He just completely disappeared. It was one of those weird things.
I feel like because he has a funny – well, it's not a funny name. It's just Guttenberg. You know, it just has a few syllables.
Sounds awfully
in it.
Foreign.
I think he kind of had a, you know, like that Simpsons parody is like, who makes Steve Guttenberg a star? He's an easy punchline, and so everyone made fun of him in the 80s, and I don't know. Maybe he deserved his success now that I'm thinking about it.
Yeah. He was in a great episode, my favorite episode of this show that used to be on Starz called Party Down. Did y'all ever see that?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah,
He played himself, but it was... Is a really great episode.
Yeah. Ah, Party Down. I like that show. That's good. Yeah. Okay. Okay, Maria Full of Grace. We're going to talk about Maria Full of Grace.
All right, John.
Okay. So anyway, this movie's in Spanish. No. So I was able to get the captions on, and we're good. Oh, by the way, it's always difficult for us, for Roy and I, to take notes while viewing non-English movies. And so
I love hearing the native language, but if I'd had a choice, I would have done dubbed just so I could pay better attention.
Because I'm always looking down and writing stuff down. And then I tend to...
Then you
got to
rewind scenes.
Yeah. So Melissa, let me know if there's anything big that I miss. But anyway... Maria, she's hanging out in Colombia, and she has a boyfriend, and he's like kind of whatever, and he's not adventurous enough to like scale roofs and stuff. She works at the rose factory. She has this gizmo that just like dethorns roses. Seems like kind of an okay job. I think it seems like an okay job. I don't like her boss very much. He's kind of like, whatever, you know, it's kind of a little bit of a power trip. Anyway, she throws up on the roses, and she has a disagreement with her boss, and she realizes she's pregnant, and she has this really bratty sister who has a kid of her own, but she's always sort of young. I mean...
Does her sister work? Because they're always yelling at her to support the family. But
I just wish the sister would just be just a little bit more appreciative, you know? I mean, because they're in a situation. They're in a household where it's Maria and her sister with a kid and their mom. And so, Maria has to help make ends meet in this household. I just wish the sister was just cooler about it, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, and just realizing that, you know, hey, Maria is kind of, you know, her freedom and agency is invaded because you have a kid, and I just wish you could all just like work together on it, you know. And so anyway, that sucks.
They could have been a mewling team.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Okay. So, she meets a hot guy on a bike.
He is hot.
His name's Franklin. He's the Colombian James Franco, is what he's known as.
And just as creepy, too.
Yeah. He's got kind of a creepy face, but, you know, he's got a great jacket. And, you know, he just kind of says, hey, have you considered mewling? I don't know if they call it mewling.
Have you thought of mewling?
Yeah.
When she starts to freak out, he says, don't worry, baby. And you know things are going to be okay.
He hooks her up with the mewling company, and they do a thing. I was kind of this sort of aggravated me because he said, "Okay, you know, look, I know, like, because they say some truths that they're kind of frank with her about. Okay, these are some things you're going to have to do.
But don't worry, we'll help you out on this. When she talks to another one of the mules, Lucy talks about, like, the lies they tell you. Because I was, when they were sort of introducing it, you know, like the guy who was interviewing her, who said, how's your system, how's this, you know, and he gave her the money, like, okay, no questions asked, you know, this is just, you know, for helping us out. We know it's not for everybody. I was honestly thinking, it's like, you know what? This mule organization, they're kind of cool in a way, you know.
They're one of the better muling organizations.
They're one of the better muling organizations. Exactly what I was thinking. But I feel like the nice things that, you know, the organization did, that Franklin and that old guy did, it was a really great way to earn trust. You know, so that they could reveal harsher truths later, like, hey, you don't swallow two of these pills, you swallow 60 of these pills or whatever it is.
I think she has either 62 or 65. I can't remember how many she does.
Which,
and her larger friend only does 50. That doesn't seem fair.
Right, yeah.
Anyway.
I don't know. She was like a foot shorter, so I don't know.
She was shorter. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
I don't think your stomach gets shorter.
Yeah, I don't know.
But anyway, I was really, I mean, look, I didn't fact check this. I was just really surprised that rather than hiring 10 more people, that one person has to hire 50 more pills at least than I thought that they would have to do. So
I mean, it's all about profit margin, right? I guess because of the more they can send per person, because you're paying the person. And what it kind of reminds me of, right, is the middle passage in the slaves that were shipped to America, right? That they just, it was as many slaves as they could fit in one boat as possible, even though it was a really bad idea and the situation was so unsanitary, they lost a lot of slaves. But I looked at one of those and I thought, she has to fit 60 of those in her stomach.
Yeah.
And it seemed really awful.
They're really, I mean, they're pretty big. I have a hard time swallowing things. Yeah.
Yeah, so the actress didn't practice because she wanted the authentic response of doing it for the first time. So, according to IMDb.
Oh, really? Okay, so anyway, there are a bunch of mules on the plane at the same time. And she's like, oh, wow, you're on the plane too? And she says, yeah, they stick us on the on the plane, because then if one of us gets caught, then, you know, the other ones can slip by. It kind of seems like that's not the case. I kind of get the sense that it's just a group rate, that they can get all the people on the plane at the same time, because the customs officers, when they land, they don't seem, like, when one of them gets caught, they still interview everybody. They still suspect everybody. I don't really think the whole, hey, if one of us gets caught, then the other one slipped through really works that well. I think they were just trying to, you know, do like a group raid on tickets.
They detained two of them, right? Two of the four. So,
yeah.
And I don't know if it's just like the customs guys are too busy, they can't handle four people, or I don't know. But anyway, I mean, half of them, right? And then she was lucky enough to be pregnant, so they couldn't x-ray her.
They couldn't x-ray her, so she slips past for that reason. I'm surprised they didn't stop her friend Blanca, because because, I mean, she specifically says, hey, don't dress up too much. And Blanca, she was, you know, on the town. She was dressed up way more than in the Rose Factory, so.
Well, what about Lucy, who's, like, just sweating bullets, right? Like, she is. Oh, goodness.
Gosh. Okay, so then the bad guys pick him up, take him to the hotel, and in the hotel, that's when they're just supposed to they can't use the toilet. They have to, like, exit these pills in the tub and rinse them off and do that whole thing.
And brush them with toothpaste.
Yeah, brush them with toothpaste. I would have been like, oh, I didn't know I was in charge of, you know, those kind of things. I guess that kind of makes sense. The thing is, her friend Lucy is sweating, and you kind of think, oh, I hope one of those things didn't burst in her tummy. I hope that's not what's going on, but that's probably what's going on.
Yeah. So you skipped the fact that it's hard to keep those all in during a long flight. And so
I forgot about that part.
So Maria got rid of some and then re-ingested them.
She put the toothpaste on and re-consume. So, Gosh, when you have 60 of those in there, like how are they not coming out whenever? I don't want to go into the bathroom details, the potty details. Okay.
So, but it does remind me. I always had this theory that if you flushed out your system and then for a week you ate nothing but corn, that eventually you're just pooping out pure corn kernels. I'm assuming.
Okay, a valid point at this time. Yes, I think one of my companions on my mission said that he had a companion who attempted to do the entire corn. I think they got half of a turd of corn that worked, but that's just what I heard. I don't know if that's true. It's probably not.
I had a science teacher once who encouraged us to eat corn and then look at our poop so that we could see, you know, it undigested, basically.
Finally, science class is interesting.
Hi, Mr. Compton, if you're listening, if you're one of the three listeners. He was actually an excellent teacher. He was very funny. You know, he almost got hammered in the balls once trying to prove a point. So, you know, he will give up his body for science, but also make you look at your poop after you eat corn. So
that's nice. Yeah. Nice. So we had a science teacher that made us watch a video of herself giving birth.
What?
So that was nice. Did you take
that? Supposed to act as birth control or something?
I don't know. It was just like and since we're talking about the reproductive system, here's how it works. Hold on, I recognize that woman. It's you.
Recognize her from between her legs, I hope. That's a whole different smile there.
You will from now on. So that's good.
Sorry, John.
Okay, no problem. Okay, so I'm dancing around it. The thing is, they wake up and they find the bathroom tub is covered in blood. They realize they probably murdered the girl who had the thing explode. Lucy. Fortunately, Lucy provided Maria with the phone number of her sister that she's been meaning to visit, but she's been ashamed to visit. And they go to the sister's house. She hooks them up with a Colombian labor helper guy who kind of helps the Colombian community, with certain things and getting jobs and, you know, figuring stuff out and stuff like that. And he kind of discovers, who she is and what she what's going on. And he says, and she goes, yeah, I'm pretty sure Lucy died. He finds the image of Lucy's body. She's like, hey, could you please tell her sister that she's dead? Maria kind of has a hard time doing that. She doesn't get around to doing that before he calls and says, where can we ship Lucy's body or whatever? It's a really uncomfortable situation. This is all on Maria. She's 17 years old. And he could have done a better job, determining if Lucy's sister Carla was aware of Lucy's death. But Lucy and Blanca, they struggle for a little while, sleeping on the floor and everything, but then they go to steal back the pellets that they took when they fled the hotel room, and they go back to the drug dealers, and miracle upon miracles, the drug dealers, they still convince the drug dealers to pay them.
To pay them, yeah.
Yeah.
That was very unrealistic.
Yeah, I was very surprised by that. And I think they draw the line at paying Lucy, the woman who died. But then they stick Blanca on the plane, and Maria decides to stick around.
Stay.
Yeah, she's sticking around. She's an American now, and I like to believe that what she does now is she stays and she cleans house on the drug dealers. She is not going to stop until all the drug dealers are dead.
I thought you were going to say she cleans house because she's Hispanic, and I was going to have to smack you.
Oh, sorry, no. We always say clean house in a Charles Bronson way, in that he messes a lot of people up, kills a lot of bad guys. Yeah.
So not just that she melts into American society and kind of does what Lucy's sister did. Mm-hmm. She stays behind, and it turns into a revenge film.
Yeah.
like a Death Wish 3 or something.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Maria Full of Vengeance coming soon to a theater near you. It's the next film in this, yeah.
We're going we'll get a little gory real quick. Lucy died from one of the things exploding inside of her or breaking open. But the drug dealers are going to get their drugs, and so the autopsy report is that she was slit open and her stomach was cut open so they could retrieve the drugs, which is really gross. Probably where all the blood came from.
That's insane to be like, okay, you know, I mean, and this is just the ultimate, you know, it's like the bottom line. We're going to make people swallow 60 of these instead of 10, which is like, I guess, the normal daily allotted recommended, you know, Surgeon General warning, you know, it's like, yeah, maybe this is how many, you know, pellets full of drugs you should, but they're going to make one person swallow 60 instead of like, hiring more people to do it or figuring out some other way to get the thing. But it's just so telling that it's like, okay, we're going to cut a girl's stomach open to retrieve like one of these things. You know, that's the, you know, the business is talking that much.
Yeah.
That's the kind of action that you're going to do.
So I work with a guy who used to work for ICE, and he said that this is actually really common, like that this is a common method of moving drugs into the country, swallowing these pellets. And oh, man.
I mean, I guess it makes sense because, you know, I mean, it's, you know, because what's customs going to do? They're not going to cut everybody open who comes into the country. Like,
you can't cut open everybody.
Yeah. And so it's like this horrific thing. I guess, you know, the business proves that it's successful, I suppose.
Yeah.
And the money can be made.
Right, because they figure in the sunken costs of people who get caught, right? And so I think that's part of why everyone has to take 60, because they know they're going to lose a certain percentage. Mm-hmm. I thought this was a great movie, by the way, Melissa, and to the point, like, it had a real impact on me. So when I went to bed that night, I dreamt about this movie.
Really?
And in my dream, it was me and Lucy and Maria, and we were fleeing from the drug dealers but also trying to get back to Colombia, and for some reason we thought we were going to stow away in the wing of an airplane. I don't even know if that's possible. I think that's where the fuel goes, but but that was my dream. And but I love, because like, this movie wasn't, like you said, it's not like this big action thriller, and there's like, and you don't, it's not like the glitzy glamorous, right? It's like, this is the tedious side of what all this is about, right? And these are the people who are involved, and this is kind of the cost. And then, like, to see her at the end, you know, she went through all that and it was awful, but also she now kind of has an opportunity to give her unborn child a chance, right? Mm-hmm. At a real life, like Lucy's sister did. And she has that talk with Lucy's sister where she's like, well, you know, I the first time you call back home for a birthday or whatever, and you miss everyone so much, but you realize that there's just nothing back there for you, right? And so, I mean, I'm sure she's gonna have some pretty crappy jobs, but I don't know. It's just like the end result somehow is worth it to her for the opportunity of raising her child not in Colombia. I'm sure Colombia is lovely, and there's plenty of lovely things there and plenty of lovely jobs, but this was a fascinating movie. It's not what I thought it would be, and it's interesting because it's steeped in all this Catholic symbology. I mean, the poster, right? It looks like she's taking communion, mm-hmm. and the title and everything, but do they ever mention that she's Catholic? We just assume she
is. It's implied just because she's Latina. I mean, that's what we all are. I was raised and indoctrinated into it, and you know, I mean, there's a lot more evangelicals, like a lot of people who have left the church because of all the scandals. They missed like they missed the community, you know, the sense of community you get from being a part of a church. And so a lot of them have been kind of swept up by evangelicals. And that's why, and not to get too political, but that's why like a lot of Latinos voted for Trump, you know, because everybody assumes that we're all Democrats or whatever, but a lot more are becoming conservative, and it's because of religion. You know, we're religious people by and large. I'm a heathen. I left the church and I did not get swept up by any other. I am an avowed heathen. And, but a lot, I mean, you know, like my family, a lot of them are non-denominational Christians now, you know, because they couldn't abide by what was going on in the Catholic Church, but they needed that sense of community, and they needed to have a place to go worship. And that it's very, very strong in amongst all the Latino countries, and Colombia is no different. So I think it's just sort of, I'm guessing maybe the filmmakers just expect us to know that.
Yeah.
It was never actually said.
Yeah. So I've spent about a year and a half of my life in Brazil, and I mean, like you said, the community is very, very Catholic, right? Mm-hmm. And I mean, lots of wonderful people. But yeah, so coming from Utah, right, where Utah's very, very LDS or Mormon, and then going to like a very, very Catholic environment, it was definitely different. Yeah, and so I agree with you, right? I think we just kind of assume, and there's probably more symbology in here or more a deeper dive that we can take, but I don't know. I didn't focus a whole lot on the Catholic aspect of this film, so maybe I missed some stuff, but I thought it was a great movie.
Yeah.
And there you go.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you. I usually star. I don't have any starred comments. I think, you know, I mentioned everything I have to mention. Okay. Melissa, what did we miss?
I mean, I don't think you really missed anything. I think you touched upon the main reasons why I wanted y'all to watch this movie. Again, I like female-centric movies. Two out of the three that I asked y'all to watch were female-centric. But also, you know, I wanted one Latino one because I'm a Latina myself. And, you know, we just discussed Coco on the other podcast. I was like, well, I can't ask them to watch that. I just talked about that one. But, you know, I mostly want people to see like the desperation, but aspect that I wish they had kind of touched on, but I sort of understand why they didn't. The reason why a lot of countries like Colombia are like they are is because of the U.S. appetite for drugs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cartels can take a hold of a country like Colombia, like Mexico, like Guatemala, and there's so much incentive to, you know, form these cartels and do these terrible things because there's so much money because of the American appetite. They never went there here. They sort of presented the USA as like the city on the hill. You know what I mean? Like the beacon of hope, which it can be. And look, I'm saying this as the great granddaughter of migrant farm workers who toiled in the fields their whole adult lives from the moment they found out they were pregnant with my grandpa and came to the USA. And they, even though they toiled in those fields and earned next to nothing, they lived the American dream. You know, they had the American family. They bought the house. Maybe it was in a crime-ridden area and, you know, it wasn't exactly like a picket fence and whatever. But, you know, they still had what was attainable to them of the American dream. And even as I saw that growing up, I still always knew that the USA in a lot of ways is the enemy of Latin America because of things like the appetite for drugs. If Americans stop using drugs today, you wouldn't see things like this happening. You know, I mean, yes, some of those drugs go to other countries, but it's mostly here. And just as an example of the influence of American appetite on the poverty in other countries and the crime in other countries, you know how avocados have just become this huge thing? Like, white people finally figured out avocados are delicious, and so, like, you know, avocado toast and avocado mousse and avocado ice cream and all kinds of crazy Steph, sorry. Now the cartels have started murdering avocado farmers and taking over their farms.
Jeez.
Because of all the money that can be made from the American appetite for avocados. And so, yeah, we're talking like multi-generational family farms that are now run by the cartels. And if you don't comply, you get murdered. And that's it. And it's specifically because of U.S. appetite. And so while I understand that they wanted to keep the focus on Maria and her struggle, her decisions and why she made them, and try and make what a lot of people call black and white decisions, make it much more gray. And I appreciate the hell out of this movie for that. But there's a part of me that feels like there's a missed opportunity for a little education, because I don't think most Americans think that they're the reason why these countries are poor. And look, I'm a Chicana, I'm a Mexican American, but I'm pretty pale myself. And so depending on who you're talking to, some people think I pass for white and others are like, no, she's clearly Mexican. You know, it just depends on who you talk to. But in the places where I can pass for white, people start talking shit about, they start talking smack about Latinos. And you know, because they think that I'm one of them, you know, a white person. And so they feel comfortable talking about these things and saying how we're lazy and, oh, if we could just be educated, these things wouldn't happen. And, you know, the whole country's corrupt and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, they have this very, very specific notion that they've probably taken from terrible movie stereotypes and not from actual experience knowing Latinos, you know. And they don't realize the role that the USA plays in it. So if I had a studio note, it would be that I wish maybe they'd gone into that a little. But I also see how that could have been a big distraction from the main story.
You know, you mentioned something just really quick, kind of a pet peeve I have. This weird conflicting notion of, oh, no, we don't want them here because they're too lazy, but also we don't want them here because
they're taking jobs.
Yeah.
So which is it? Are we lazy? Yeah. We don't want to work. I mean, yeah, exactly. But I guess it depends on which argument what's convenient at the time. Is, I think, which one they pick up there. Yeah, that's an excellent point.
So let me ask real quickly, and we don't have to get into it. Do you like Coco? I never know, because these movies, when Disney tries to treat another culture, and I'm like, I don't know if they did a good job.
I loved it.
That makes me happy.
They got so much right about that movie, and it was beautifully rendered. It gives, being my family being from Mexico, you know, I have a different perspective of it than I think a lot of other Americans. And I've always felt, because it's not all just narcos, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's, yes, the cartels are heavy in some areas and you don't really want to go to those areas, but most of Mexico is just about families. You know, it's this beautiful, colorful, resplendent country with a rich history and the best food on the planet. If I'm biased, I know, but whatever. I wish that more Americans would see that movie, or see Mexico the way I do. And I think that movie probably helped some of them, you know. And also, it just came at a great time, because it came right as Trump was in office. And not to get political, but, like, you know, he said some disparaging things about Mexicans. And so to see a movie that was such a positive light of Mexico and Mexican culture was just beautiful. And also, it explains a little bit about why a lot of Mexicans have this kind of almost gallows humor sometimes, because we have a different relationship with death. And I think Diego Los Muertos explains that. Yes, we mourn our dead. Of course we do. We're sad. We cry. But we also are thankful for the time we had with them. And that's what we celebrate every year on Dia de los Muertos. It's a celebration. You don't cry on Dia de los Muertos. You celebrate the life and the time you had with that person. It's a party, you know? And so we see things a little different, maybe, in terms of death and stuff. And they got all of that so right. It was amazing to me.
So they almost did as good a job on that as they did with Pocahontas, is what I'm hearing. So you're talking about how when you're around people who don't know you're Mexican, and when they talk that way. So it reminded me, there's a really, really funny Saturday Night Live skit with Eddie Murphy. When he's dressed up and put makeup on like a white person, and he goes, and it's about how people react around him when they don't know he's black, and it's just super funny.
I know. I can't believe they revealed all those things about, you know,
our secrets.
Yeah, our white people secrets.
One of the scenes is what he's like trying to get a bank loan, and the loan manager is another African American man. And he's like, you have no money, you have no job, how can I even think about it? And then like the white bank manager comes and says, why don't you go ahead and take a break? And he's like, that silly Negro, of course you can have a loan.
Well, yeah.
Like, pay us back whenever you want. In fact, don't.
The concept is there's this that white people just always give things to each other. which, you know, it's – I always thought that was like super funny, but it's – you know, it's not true, but it's also just a little bit like
it's close.
it's the otherisms thing. It's like, okay, we're nice to people like us, yeah, and yeah. Just that the idea of that, yeah. I did. Oh, this reminds me. That's another thing that Lucy said about America, which, you know, I don't know, Melissa, if this kind of misses the mark, or if maybe it's just – maybe this is kind of a sarcastic line the movie is saying, but Lucy says – like, because Maria asks her about America, about the United States, what it's like. Yeah. And she says, it's too perfect. Everything's straight, which I thought was just a weird thing to say. Like, they had a chance to say, it's like, okay, you know what? It's nice, but, you know, it has its problems. But she actually kind of says – there's just I don't know, I guess what she was saying is, you know, she still has this sense of idealism, I think, maybe possibly because her sister is there and, yeah, you know, thriving the way she is, and maybe that like kind of speaks to kind of her sense of shame and not seeing her sister and kind of thinking even more highly of America than perhaps she should, but I'm not sure about that. I just thought it was a weird line.
I sort of took it as like it's so straight, like she doesn't belong there, maybe, because she doesn't have her life together, and like you have to have your life together to live there or something. And because I think she probably thinks her sister very much has her life together there, when clearly things, you know, aren't as great as they, I mean, it's a tiny apartment. There's no room for their crib practically. They have his brother sleeping on the floor there, you know, like it's not as together as maybe Lucy thought, which she would have known if she would have had the guts to knock on that door and,
yeah,
and come in, you know. I guess I took it differently. Like she was almost like Lucy does admire it and wants to be a part of it, but doesn't feel like she belongs because of her shame. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's sort of how I saw it.
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. That totally makes sense. Okay, Melissa, go ahead and let's talk about Barfy.
So Barfy is, without a doubt, one of my favorite movies of all time. I said earlier that I just kind of happened upon it on accident because I'm a fan of the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast on NPR. I don't know how many times I've watched it since then, but it's several. This movie is like an amalgam of genres that shouldn't work, but somehow does. Because I think when people try to meld genres together, it just doesn't always work. It seems kind of, you know, slapped together or something. But this just works. So it starts out, Barfy is the actual name of the main character. Well, not his actual name, but it's the name that he can say, basically. He's deaf and he doesn't really talk much. And so when people ask his name, he says Barfy. He can say that. He's kind of he's poor. He's like a ne'er-do-well sort of. he lives with his dad, who's very ill. And you know, the cops are always after him because he does try. And in your notes on Facebook, Roy, I remember you saying, you know, like, well, he's kind of an actual criminal or something like that. Like, because he does try to, like, rob a bank and do other things that are bad. But we're supposed to still love him. And we do, I think. I don't know anybody who I've had watch this movie who thinks he's a bad guy. You know, he's doing the wrong things for the right reasons, like to pay for his dad's life-saving surgery or something to that effect.
And there's a bit of an innocence about him, too, right?
Yes, very much so. And it starts off kind of as a comedy caper. It's very Charlie Chaplin-esque, and they do make a lot of nods to that, as you pointed out in your notes as well. But it morphs into this love story, a very unlikely love story. And part of the reason why I love this movie so much is that Barfi is deaf and mostly mute. And Gilmil, the woman he eventually falls in love with, is autistic. And one of the reasons why Priyanka Chopra took the role is because she said that in India, there was not really, at the time when this movie came out, which wasn't that many years ago, by the way, that in India, people didn't talk about autism. In fact, there wasn't really an awareness of what it even was. And so she wanted to sort of help kind of erase the stigma by portraying this autistic woman who has a lot of depth and complexity to her and is worthy of love and capable of it as well, because I think a lot of us do not look at autistic people as being worthy or capable of love. And that's really, you know, to our shame, I think, as a society.
I have an autistic son, but he's on the higher end of functionality. And obviously her character is closer to the lower end of functionality. But yeah, I mean, I have that worry all the time. Like, you know, who's going to love my kid, right?
Yeah. I didn't know that when I suggested this film. But I imagine a lot of parents do. And when I was a teenager in high school, I spent my summers working at a camp for kids with disabilities, and we had a whole week, like each week was sort of a theme to help us prepare. You know, like one was you know, a week where it was all just kids who were like ADHD, you know, we knew we had to like kind of double up on people, you know, because you were just exhausted and trying to keep up with them. Right. And we did have an autism week. And the reason why we split that, we weren't trying to like segregate them. It's just easier to get counselors who specialize in certain types of disabilities all in one week, you know, and get them trained for that particular week. And the parents of some of these kids, you know, when they would see pictures of them doing these activities like canoeing or archery or whatever, you know, horseback riding, and seeing them do these quote unquote normal things, it really kind of gave them hope, like, okay, maybe somebody can see my kid as normal, you know, because that's sort of what they wanted, you know, because they thought then they would have a better life that way. And I always think about that when I watch this movie, because, you know, I wonder what Gilmil's parents wanted for her, but mostly actually what her grandfather wanted for her, because her grandfather is the one who loved her more than anything. Her dad really tried to more take advantage of her and used her for the inheritance that her grandpa left her.
Well, and he tried to kidnap her and get her.
Yeah, exactly.
The ransom himself.
Yeah. But you would like to think that when she was first born and maybe before they understood what condition she had, that he had hopes and dreams for her, you would hope, you know, like most parents do. The love story, the unlikely love story, I think, is what I really loved about this the most, because you don't see people with disabilities portrayed as falling or being in love very often. And this just seems like a natural progression in a lot of ways. They just did it so well and in a way that was charming and entertaining. And you didn't even realize over 2.5 hours had passed, you know, by the time it's over. Yeah, this is just a beautiful love story that starts out as a comedy, sort of morphs into a love story. And then there's like a little bit of crime thing thrown in. It's so hard to describe this movie sometimes.
And it jumps around time-wise too.
Yeah, time-wise, yeah, which is always fun. And when you say, you know, it starts off like kind of a silent comedy, then it morphs into sort of a love story. It morphs into the other love story, though, right?
Yeah, there's kind of two love stories here.
Yes, going on concurrently.
I feel really dumb about it because, and I think it's just the way I perceived like my own like movie literacy. I kind of, you know, when he starts wooing the other woman, Shruti. And she's, you know, put together and she like doesn't want to marry this other guy and she's extremely beautiful, very conventionally beautiful. And then she kind of does those little glances at him like, oh, what a goofball. But, you know, I think I'm falling for him. You know, like that movie, you know, literacy is just like, okay, this is the person he is romantically in love with. And I felt sort of like an idiot not realizing that the stuff with Jill Mill was also a love story. Because it wasn't telegraphed like in the normal traditional like movie romantic ways. It was like they were growing together. They were like within this relationship together, which turns out to be the real love story rather than sort of the fun, flirty infatuation love story of the other one.
Well, the Stockholm Syndrome love story.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
but to your point, right? Because that's so just plot wise, right? Mm-hmm. The girl that he woos is already engaged, and her mother persuasions her to get married to the stiff that she's engaged to, and of course she later regrets it, like her mother later regretted not marrying the guy that he loved, right? But by the time like she leaves the guy and she comes back around, Barfi is now like full on living with Jill Mill, and you kind of think it's like, oh, well, he's being kind to her, he's being sweet to her, and even like for a while in Kolkata, when they're kind of going around, it looks like Barfi is still sort of favoring Shruti, right? But then it's when Jill Mill like becomes separated from them and lost, when you realize, oh no, he actually, you know, he deeply loves her, right? And they have this whole thing with the pole, like the light pole test, right? Which, John, you put the angry face, but
okay, yeah, I'm glad you acknowledged that. Okay, you know what? Barfi's great. I just don't appreciate. Maybe I'm old. Maybe
scaring
I'm just
your date to death.
I'm just not into the whole. First of all, I'm not into cutting things down. I'm not into the vandalism aspect of it, and I'm not into the whole. Hey, I'm going to do this weird thing, and are you going to be weird enough to pass the test for me? I don't like passing tests for my lovers. Yeah.
I can agree with you there. As a woman, we get tested all the time, especially by men. Like I'm a huge sports fan, right?
Sure. That's loaded. You're asking for trouble when people challenge you on that, I'm guessing.
Yes, if a man is a sports fan and another man, a fellow man, is like, oh, I'm into sports, you'll start talking about your favorite team, shooting the breeze. But as a woman, I say, oh, I'm into sports. They want me to know like who played shortstop for the 1922 Yankees. And I don't know. Oh, sorry. Sorry. I don't effing know. Because who is an encyclopedia like that? Nobody. You know what I'm saying? So if you don't pass this archaic, ridiculous, unpassable test, and oh, yeah, you're not really a sports fan, you know, but they would never question a fellow man that way.
Yeah.
So I agree with you on that. Although I do love that Jimmel was the first one who didn't flinch or whatever when the pole fell. That was very kind of a sweet moment, but I agree with you there.
So this movie is so full of just like tiny little moments and details and glances and and gestures that just that are the whole movie, right? And I really love those things. I will say, like, when it became apparent that, like, that Barfi and Jillmill were kind of forming a relationship, there was just a little bit of me that was kind of frustrated, the idea of that because he has a disability, he can't actually be happy, or a normal person could not love him and be happy with him. He has to be paired off with someone else who also has a disability. And it just reminded me of the Rise of Skywalker, right, where all of a sudden, out of nowhere, that African-American actress shows up so that Finn now has a love interest, right? Mm-hmm. So there's someone like him he can love. And so I kind of felt that way initially when it was kind of moving in this direction, but they do such a good job, and the relationship is so genuine, and the joy is genuine, and it's and he's not settling for anything, and he's not upset or like feeling like, well, this is the best I can do, right? It's just, it's genuine, and you can feel it, and you can see it, and it's beautiful. I think it's very well done. So anyway. And I love the inspector.
Yeah.
Should we mention, like, the whole kidnapping thing, right?
Yeah.
Because he needed $7,000 to save his dad's life, and some kidnappers, who turned out to be her father, mm-hmm. was kidnapping her because he doesn't have access to her trust fund. And I guess when the grandfather died, he left all the money to her and her trust fund. So the father arranged for her to be kidnapped, but then Barfi kidnaps her from the kidnappers. And then Barfi has her for a while, and then they get separated, and she ends up calling you said, John, that this is like the home that takes care of people with disabilities, right? Is that what that is?
I don't know what it's called, but I mean, it's where she's started.
It's where she started.
Because, yeah, she started there, right? And then she moved back with her family until her grandfather died, and then she wound up back at that home. Okay, so wait, what was your question?
I was just making sure I understood it correctly, because it gets really messy there, and then I think there's like that moment where the police are going to frame him for the kidnapping, and there's a brief moment where you think that maybe she's dead, right? And it's kind of weird because they do mix genres, because sometimes it's like this normal narrative movie, and then all of a sudden you're moving to like an interview. It's an interview now. But I will say it took me about a third of the film to settle in, because when they were just doing a lot of the Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton homage stuff, I thought this is what this whole movie is going to be like, and that's fine. But this movie evolves as it goes along. And it does, I think it does a good job. And I never would have watched this.
No.
So, Melissa, thank you very much.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's funny how many people end up thanking me for introducing them to this movie. And that was like, that's like, I think that's great. It's just this weird, wonderful little movie that I think a lot of people outside of India have never seen, but should watch. It's really great.
Yeah. As soon as I finished it, I went and found my wife, and I said, do you want to watch a movie about a deaf guy and a girl with autism? And she said, how long is it? I said, 2.5 hours. And then she said, no, because it's like 9 o'clock at night. Right. And so, anyway, there's some, I have a lot of awards. I have a lot of awards, and, then we can cry during the awards.
Yeah, so I will tell you. I was skeptical, kind of all the way up to the end. Like, I'm like, okay, yeah, this is growing on me, and because the genres change so much, and I think the switch at the end is really kind of what converted me, because there was a little bit of me that sort of hated the Shruti relationship because the whimsy of Barfi doing his thing and the beautiful Shruti just kind of like side glancing at him like, oh, this goofy guy, you know, he's actually really cool. It just it worked on me in that, like, okay, these are two pretty people and I hope they get together.
Oh, she's so beautiful, by the way. I hope you don't mind me saying so, Melissa, but there, Jill Mill as well. Like,
yeah,
I mean, she's beautiful. I think Indian women are so beautiful.
Dude, yeah. I'm bisexual. I think they're gorgeous. I mean, I would not kick either of them out of bed for eating crackers. That's for sure.
Yeah, no, definitely some serious beauty. But I think, you know, the weird adjustment from like flirtatious romantic love, which I totally believed, and I really, really believe that Barfi loved Shruti as well. She wasn't just this superficial, beautiful woman. She had depth, and she was beautiful, and she was, you know, kind of who you think is that Barfi is going to save from her loveless marriage, and that doesn't happen. But what does happen is, you know, the little switcheroo where it's like, okay, this movie moves from the fun, flirtatious sort of romantic relationship to the deep, life-affirming relationship within the same movie. And it kind of – and I'm just really impressed with how it pulled the rug out from under me, because I was – because I really grew to love Jill Mill, but I kind of – I thought, you know, I kind of took it as a like – you know, a more of a platonic love palling around. And even though that's what, you know, is kind of portrayed until, you know, I'm like, oh, dummy, of course, you know, this is what the movie's about. I appreciated the love based on that kind of the platonic ideal is sort of a base for something deeper than that, than deeper even than, you know, the fun flirty romance of the other one. So I guess it's hard to describe. I don't know what I'm saying.
You did pretty good.
I don't know. Yeah.
All right. Well, I mean, is there more that you'd like to say about this, Melissa?
I kind of get what John is saying. I really do. The one thing I want to say, there's very little I would change about this movie, because I just really love it. Yeah. And like we were talking on the other podcast when we did this for my birthday last year.
I think I know what you're going to say. I can't wait.
that, you know, we're like, if we had to cut it, because 2.5 hours is too long for a lot of people, like Roy's wife, but although the time of night, I'm sure, had something to do with that. But like, it, you know, a lot of people don't want to watch something that's more than like 90 minutes to 2 hours or something like that. So where would we cut? And nobody could really make major cuts to it, you know? Mm-hmm. But one thing I didn't like, and I did point this out on the other podcast, is that with Shruti, okay, there was a beautiful moment that just made you cry. It made you just like, it just tore your heart up. It's towards the end of the movie where Barfi is trying to find Jill Mill, and she finally comes to the window and screams for him. But of course, he can't hear her.
Yeah.
But Shruti can. And she has this moment. Mm-hmm. She stops in her tracks, and you can see the anguish on her face, because she has to make a very fast decision that will impact the rest of her life. Mm-hmm. Does she tell Barfi that she's there, knowing that they are in love and that he will go to her and that'll be the end of that? Or does she keep going and maybe help him nurse his broken heart and get in his good graces, and then he'll fall for her again? Like, she has to make this decision very quickly, and she makes what is ultimately, I think most people would agree, the correct one, and tells him, and he goes back, of course, to her, to Jill Mill. So it's this beautiful moment, right? And you, in my mind, that was enough suffering, you know what I mean, for her. Mm-hmm. But okay. Then we see her later on in life, and she clearly has never fallen out of love with him. And never married again. Never, not that marriage should be the ultimate goal, you know, but she never seemed to get over him and have happiness of her own. Even the job she takes up is still, still sort of related to him in a sense, because she's helping disabled people and she's helping deaf students, you know. And I just feel like maybe somebody who wrote the script was projecting or something. I don't know. But, like, I wish she could have had something else for herself instead of living the rest of her life sort of in the shadow of her love for Barfie.
Deserves a happy ending for having made the right choice.
Exactly.
Difficult choice.
I totally hear what you're saying. I think I'm a little bit more forgiving of it. They probably could have done a little bit more where she's more, you know, if she doesn't get married or whatever, that she could be a little bit more secure in herself, that her love of what she does is greater than her love of Barfie, like in the end, you know? And so I think they could have done a little bit more of that. But I just realized as you were talking that I think one reason why I love the ending so much is because it reminds me so very much of Some Kind of Wonderful in the way that movie ends. You know, one of the things, you know, of course, if anybody hasn't seen Some Kind of Wonderful, stop listening to me right now. But, you know, when Keith, you know, and Watts get together, another one of my favorite things about them getting together is Amanda Jones, you know, finally holding her head up high and not being defined on who she's with. And she is just, and Amanda Jones is totally alone. And she is just so happy and proud about that. And so, yeah, I guess they could have done it a little bit better, but I think it is sort of sweet that Shruti became more than, you know, just, you know, what her parents deemed her as, you know, married to someone else, and she's doing some really great things. And it's like, okay, my love for this man led me to my love for doing these really great things. But I do agree. I think it could have shown it better. I think she could have been happier at the end, at least.
Yeah. Not so much pining. So, do you know what my major complaint is with this film? I have a really big one.
Oh, good.
What?
Yeah, it's their attempt to ageify these young actors was so poorly done. Like, they simply slapped a gray wig on Shruti, and like they were. Oh.
They all looked hot. They were all hot. They're hot, hot old people. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
That's fine. Anyway. Well, no, Melissa, what I thought you were going to say about your complaint was that there was a scene, and when I was watching this with Katie, she's like, wait, what is this? I know this scene. What is this scene? And there's a scene from The Notebook. where Shruti's mom drives her to the lumberjack's place and says, I could have married him, but I didn't because, you know, I did the right thing, you know, whatever is said. And I was very confused because I proudly have never seen The Notebook. I obviously wasn't dating anybody when The Notebook came out or during The Notebook's DVD release time of, you know, a decade or whatever that was. So I've never seen The Notebook. And so I kind of missed it, but I was complaining to you two earlier about how hectic my day was today. I was planning on sending you one of the YouTube videos of, you know, this guy in India kind of complaining, but just kind of pointing out all the things that Barfie stole from. I think one of the, like, The Notebook is kind of the one where you're kind of like, you didn't have to do this one. But a lot of the other ones are, okay, you know, he stole from, like, the director stole from this Chaplin film. And in watching the scene side by side, I was like, okay, you know what, it's an homage. But I was, like, flabbergasted by the sliding door with the inspector. It wasn't just copied. It was impressive. Just the like side by side, they were exactly the same. Like, to the point where it's like, okay, you know, I can't blame him for lifting this from Chaplin because, you know, if you know, you know. And, you know, if you know it's from Chaplin, it's just like, okay, you can kind of appreciate the attention to detail that it was that exact. But I guess Barfie kind of came under some criticism, you know, because, you know, the director kind of in some people's opinion, Tarantino too much. And as much as I want to complain about this movie, I'll just quickly say the criticism about the other movies that Barfie borrows from, I don't really think they're warranted because I think, you know, the great things about Barfie are those things, but the phenomenal things about Barfie, the things that I think sets Barfie apart from pretty much every movie I've seen, is wholly original. You know, in the movie Barfie itself. So I'm kind of, you know, not really super concerned with the copycat. You know,
and the director admits, he's like, "Oh yeah, this is like he was influenced by so many previous movies and wanted to, you know, kind of pay his respects to them, and you know, in a sense." And so he fully admits that yes, they lifted from other stuff, but there is, like you said, a lot of wholly original stuff in here too, and somehow it works, you know. I don't know how they made this work. But it just does.
Yeah. No. I really like it, and I dare say I think I like it more now that we've talked about it.
So. Oh yeah.
And so, what did Katie think of these movies?
She liked them. She liked them all. She, I never ask her, like, what do you think is the best one? You know, I kind of want to save it, you know, for later. I think she was pleasantly surprised by Barfie. The length, it did have just a toll in the sense that, you know, we just had to have grilled cheese sandwiches, like, right in the middle of Barfie. It's like, I can't go on without food. So we had to take a food break in the middle of Barfie. I think she was really intrigued by Maria Full of Grace, but we laughed pretty hard with Citizen Ruth. So I think it's, you know, a good run all around.
Nice. Note she didn't vote. I would be curious to know what her favorite was. But anyway.
Okay, yeah, we'll find out.
So that's for another time, because we're going to do some awards right now, because I'm determined to go to bed by 11 o'clock. So.
Okay.
Take that.
Do you want to do contact info?
I want you to.
Okay, everybody, first of all, send us a voicemail, as Melissa did 2 weeks ago, at 801-896-4542. That's 801-896-4542. You can say anything you want. Yeah. We're not going to be beholden to our clean rating on the voicemail. So, yeah.
You're not beholden to it now unless you do some editing. Whoopsies.
Yeah. Yep. I'm giving you clearance. It's totally fine. In the meantime, find us on Facebook. That's where you can do the voting for what movies we have to watch, what genres we have to watch, and also you can make yourself known so you can actually be a guest on Yours, Mine, and Theirs, the famous international podcast. Yes, you can be a guest on Yours, Mine, and Theirs, as long as we don't get too much more popular than we are now, which we don't really see a danger of that happening. So also find us on Apple Podcasts. Give us five stars. Yeah, you can give us five stars on that one. Not just four, five stars. Leave a review. Yeah. Say whatever you want. And you can use whatever swears you want in that review. find us on Spotify. And if you have a hard time downloading any of these podcasts you're listening to, go to yoursmindtheirspodcast.blogspot.com, and you can download all the MP3s directly and also see what picture we used for each podcast. If nothing else, if you want any more help or if you want to chat us up, and also we're begging you to, go to our email, yoursmindtheirspodcast@gmail.com. So go ahead and do that. Okay, so awards?
Awards!
All right, here we go. Okay, Roy, best title?
Maria Full of Grace.
Oh, okay. Melissa?
Yeah, I agree. I love the play on words. It just haven't been raised Catholic.
Oh, okay. I went with Citizen Ruth. I just like that she's totally a citizen, and her name is Ruth. And I don't know. It just evokes sort of the power you have as a citizen. Okay, so Melissa, of these, what was your favorite poster?
Maria Full of Grace, again, because I think it brings back that, you know, growing up Catholic, and it did look like, you know, a Eucharist, you know, that they would give you at Mass, and it brought all that back. I haven't, other than like funerals and weddings, I haven't been to a Mass in years and years and years, and you know, maybe it's not the best image to evoke, because I have had some bad experience having gone to Catholic school most of my life. But it works. It's just really well done.
Yeah, I totally agree. I'm going to go with Maria Full of Grace on that poster. That imagery is just really perfect. Okay, Roy.
Yep. Well chosen.
All right, Maria Full of Grace. Okay, Roy, follow-up question. What is the worst poster you've ever seen?
Barbie?
Yes, I agree. I really must discuss the marketing of the movie Barfy. I mean, it's like, hey, gang, let's get together. You know, we have a huge hill to climb because the title of our movie is Barfy. It does not translate well in English at all. So we're going to have to come up with the best poster we can think of. Or should we just, you know, have him with a goofy face on a bike and call it a day? Okay, let's call it a day. So
it's a really bad poster.
Yeah, it did not help my enthusiasm for starting the movie Barfy. Yeah. Roy, best opening credits.
So I already discussed it in my sum up, but the Citizen Ruth, I love how they started out like so classy and then it quickly switches to getting syphilis in the abandoned apartment.
What was that, Harry Connick Jr. playing in the background?
Yeah.
Okay, Melissa, do you have opening credits?
No, agreed. Okay. Yeah, it's funny because like Barfy starts out like, you know, with sponsorships and all this other stuff, and it's just weird and kind of awkward, you know, because we don't have that in front of our movies usually. And I know they had proper opening credits later, but it was just strange. And then, you know, the Maria Fuller Grace opening credits, I mean, there was really nothing special about them.
Yeah.
I must admit the Maria Fuller Grace opening credits, you know, I kind of wasn't into the music, but then the guitar work really picked up toward the end of the credits. I noted that. I'm like, hey, this guitar work is really picking up. But then the movie started, so. I'm actually going to go with Barfy for the opening credits because, you know,
because
what?
Because of the sponsor?
Because after the practice credits, they got the second set of credits right, which was just, you know, some fun scenes at the beginning of the movie with Barfy hanging around doing his thing. So, Melissa, best technology.
I think in Citizen Ruth, there were, like, when the reporters came, and they had the vans with the satellite dishes on them and stuff, and like just this kind of older tech from like 30 years ago. You know what I mean? It that was kind of fun.
Okay, no, good call. Okay, Roy, technology.
Yes, yeah, so in Barfy, he creates these lamps using a bubble wand and fireflies.
Oh, bubble fireflies! That's good. That's good technology. Okay, I went with Maria's, quote, system, which worked really well, you know, when, you know, because she had a bunch of stuff in there.
Yeah, she did.
Yeah. Okay, Roy, best outfit.
Okay, Jill Mills' red cardigan with dress ensemble. I loved it.
Okay, yeah, the cardigan and dress. Is that kind of a purple-pink cardigan sort of thing?
I don't know. I'm colorblind.
Yeah, dark too. Maybe. I don't know what it is. Gray, I guess. I don't know.
Gray.
Okay, Melissa, do you have a best outfit?
I'm going with the entire wedding party at the end of Barfy.
Oh, yeah. No, that's very good. Okay, I feel like at one point, and I didn't write it down, but I remember thinking, hey, that's a pretty cool outfit. I think it was when Barfy and Jamil arrive in Darjeeling like the second time, and he's wearing like this red shirt with these really cool white pants and some nice shoes. I don't know if I'm dreaming that. Okay, but if that's not a thing, I'm just going to go with the Frida Kahlo shirt that Ruth wears.
Ah, very good.
Okay, Roy, best name.
Sure, I'm going with Blaine Gibbons.
Okay, Blaine Gibbons, okay. Melissa, best name?
I don't know if, let's just go with Barfy. I mean, because it sounds so off-putting in English.
Yes.
How does he say it?
But if you pay attention to the beginning when they explain why, it's actually really nice. It's a sweet little story, like a part of his story.
Let's see, is it like you say Murphy in a way, like, just like with, just air out your line, like, Murphy, like.
Yeah.
Yeah. I went with Jill Mill.
Yeah, I almost picked Jill Mill.
Yeah. Roy, did I let you pick a name?
You did. It was Blaine.
Oh, yeah, Blaine. That's right. Okay. getting
a good villain name.
Goes around. With the whitest name.
Yes,
Blaine.
Yes. I love it. It's not a name. Blaine. It's an appliance.
It's an appliance. It's
a household appliance. Okay.
Or a small town in Missouri.
Melissa, best food.
There was a scene in Barfi where Trudy reunites with him for the first time in a while, and you see Jimmo getting like jealous with their what are those things called? They crack open from those things from the sea, and they eat from it. Remember?
It explodes in Jill Mill's mouth.
Yeah. What are those called? I forget.
But I don't know. They look really good.
I like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I wrote that down. This isn't what I picked, but I said street thing that explodes in Jill Mill's mouth is what I wrote down. I wasn't sure what it was. Okay. Roy, best food.
Sure. So at the Stoney's house, they have a dinner where everyone gets their very own tiny little chicken.
Oh,
or whatever animal that is. Is it a quail? Cornish, I don't know.
I think it's a Cornish hen or something.
Cornish hen. Yeah, they're all eating their very own Cornish hen.
So you didn't pick the grade C grill steaks that they had.
Nope. The shoe leather steak.
I wasn't impressed with the Salisbury steaks or whatever that was. Yeah. Okay.
I wish we'd seen more eating in Indian, because Indian food is my very, very favorite cuisine. I love Indian food.
Oh, your very favorite.
Very favorite.
Hmm. Nice. Oh, man. I always, whenever I go to Bombay House, I always just get the tikka masala. But last time I went, I think they punked me, because I say, you know, give me the spicy. And I think they just, they wanted to kill me.
They know you.
Yeah,
they give you the spicy that they know you can handle by looking at you.
Yeah, that's yeah. Well, I'm glad they were that impressed with me because that was a very stressful meal. Yeah, and very stressful leftovers. Yeah.
Oh man.
Okay.
Spicy well, in.
the food I picked is Lucy's practice grapes.
Oh, the practice grapes. Those are big.
They're big grapes. Yeah.
Hmm.
Okay, Roy, best alien.
Well, it's Lucy's sister. I don't know if she's fully citizenized yet, so I'm assuming, you know, she's an alien. So there you go.
Okay. Okay, Melissa, do you have best alien? By the way, the story behind this, Melissa, is back when we did Star Trek podcasts, we picked best alien, but then we still do it for this
podcast. And for some reason, we still do it, and it always turns out to be our racist award. So.
I do not, because I did not understand what you meant.
Okay.
When I read that, I was like, there are no aliens. I did not pick a science fiction movie, which is amazing for me because I love science fiction, but I did not pick a science fiction movie.
Well, hopefully next time.
So,
Next time we talk about, we could talk about Blue Star or Red Nova or possibly Yellow.
Red Planet?
Yellow Spaceship, yeah. Oh, Red Planet.
Yellow Spaceship.
I don't know.
Is that a movie?
I hope it is, because that's what I'm picking, maybe.
Okay.
Okay, well, usually, for Alien, we kind of do, like, what's a fish out of water kind of thing. We
yeah.
We can't think of anything else. So I picked Blanca because she dressed up the most, and I think it made her seem just a little bit more out of place, I guess.
I don't want to give Blanca any awards. I hated her. God.
Oh, Blanca.
Blanca.
Oh, Blanca.
Yeah, I thought she had such good promise at the beginning when she was just, you know, hanging out, you know, flirting with guys at the Rose Factory. Okay. Okay, Melissa, do you have any special effects? What was the special effect that you appreciated?
The closest thing I could do was like, it's probably not a special effect exactly, but there were a couple of times where like Barfi was, he was on his bike and hanging onto the train, and then he ran into things poles and stuff. And I don't know if they just did it like a stunt in slow motion and then like sped it up or something. Uh-huh. You know, I don't know how they did it, if it was a practical effect or a little bit of a special effect, but I'm going to go with special effect and say that because, you know, somehow that's still, it's like one of the oldest tricks in the book. So, you know, dude running into something because he was like enamored with a pretty girl, yeah. and yet it somehow still worked here.
I thought you might say, you know, when he hides behind a car and then he grabs hold of the car and the car takes him away.
Oh, geez. Yeah, he hops on the car instead of the car yanking his arm out like a Wookiee. <Yeah.
laughs> Like, that's impressive. That's impressive joint strength, I think. okay, Roy, best FX.
So Barfy has this weird thing where he can, like, shift his nose to one side and it stays in place.
Yeah. Like, does that mean he broke his nose in the past?
I don't know. I don't know if that's a real thing that the actor is doing or what, but it's like, I don't, it's defying the laws of physics by staying bent and then he bends it the other direction. It's like his nose is made out of putty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. Okay. Yeah. Mine is definitely a practical effect, and it's just when Barfy hides in the alley and he hides in the corner. And so the inspector runs up to him and crashes into a mirror, and then he hides on the opposite side.
I love that. Yeah. And the ladder on the roof with the inspector was pretty funny.
Oh, yeah.
The ladder's great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, Roy, best location.
Well, it's Darjeeling, India. What a beautiful town. So what we saw Life of Pi, right? And wherever in India they were living in Life of Pi also looked so beautiful. And I imagine there's really gross, dirty places in India like there is in every country, but Darjeeling just looks gorgeous.
I almost picked Darjeeling. In fact, that's kind of what I picked because mine is kind of a cheat. But Melissa, what do you have for location?
Oh, 1,000% agree about Darjeeling. I mean, a friend of mine, my bestie Sophia, she her work sent her to India for like 3 weeks one time. Oh my god, I was so jealous. I've always wanted to visit. It's definitely near the top of my bucket list. You know, I mean, I've been to Asia, but just not that part of Asia, unfortunately, not yet. But I really want to go, and yeah, there's definitely some eye candy going on here, and I'm not talking about the ladies, although they were pretty great too.
Nice. Okay. I picked because I assumed it was a fake place, but I picked Tomb of the Unknown Baby. It was just referenced. Like, I want to visit the Tomb of the Unknown Baby. Now I can if I want. And that's interesting. Okay. All right. Melissa, what do you have for best song of these?
This is a tough one.
So, actually, I picked – I don't know if this is a cheat. I picked the score to Barfy, not an actual song.
Okay.
Part of the reason why I don't watch a lot of Bollywood movies is because even though visually they're very stunning, I love musicals. I love song and dance stuff. I really do. But when people are singing a song and you have to read the lyrics, it's different. Like, I don't mind subtitled movies at all. Obviously, two of the three movies I picked were subtitled. But it's different when it's a song and you have to read the lyrics and you know what I'm saying?
It
hits differently. And so it's hard for me to pick a song in another language that I understand, unless it's Spanish. I know enough Spanish to understand. I just can't speak it very well. So I get Spanish songs I can do, but like, you know, Hindi songs, obviously I don't know any Hindi. So I couldn't really pick one. And the other movies didn't really have a lot of songs in them. So for me, though, that score, it was an asset to the movie, and a movie that already has a lot of good things going for it. So, and there was this one particular moment I loved where, like, Barfy and Gilmo, they're like, going through the kind of this forested area, and they have a song playing, an actual lyric song. And he's like kicking up leaves, and then you see her come up behind him and start copying him and kicking up the leaves. And it goes from like the song to the score kind of seamlessly. I don't know if y'all remember that moment, but it was like this really perfect transition. And that's when I began to really believe that, okay, these two might be falling for each other. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So the score was just really well done, I thought.
So I feel similarly. I liked the band that kept showing up in weird places with the accordion. But since I couldn't, when I looked at the names of the songs, I'm like, I have no idea. So A La Barfy is a theme that is reprised several times, but basically I'm just saying what you are, right?
Yeah. The score was really good, yeah.
Sure.
Okay. I like the score. I kind of feel like there was maybe too much score. I wouldn't have minded just a few more scenes of just people talking. You know, just kind of give the score like a breather once in a while. But that's like a preference I have. Like, I have this weird preference in movies where I tend to think movies in general have too much music. but I guess that's a weird thing of me. But okay, the song, I had a hard time with this. Honorable mention to, in Citizen Ruth, there's a song called Don't Give Up on Baby Tanya that the protesters made up, you know, when they wanted to convince Ruth to keep baby Tanya, because she kind of mentioned that maybe she would name the baby Tanya. And it was to the tune of Battle Hymn of the Republic, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Also honorable mention to also the end of Citizen Ruth, where Ruth listens to the Jarvik Financial Tape Volume 2, which she found. At the very, very end of the credits, she's listening to the next tape in her financial series that's going to change her life. Mm. So I'm probably going to have to pick – and Melissa, you're going to have to help me because – it's the name, because I was listening to your podcast today, The Year's Mine and Theirs, Barfy, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to agree with them.
Kiss Your Franchise Goodbye, Barfy.
Oh, Kiss Your Franchise Goodbye. Yeah. Kiss Your Franchise Goodbye, the one of Barfy, where you, I think there's a song called What Do I Do With My Heart? Something like that. But it's a nice little song, and it's about love in the middle.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Roy Buskast.
Well, the big name, I'm picking Burt Reynolds. I think he plays a good bad guy. Mm-hmm. Because I kind of think of Burt Reynolds as a bad guy.
Is it possible to like take Burt Reynolds seriously? When every time I think of Burt Reynolds, I only think of Norm MacDonald doing Burt Reynolds like on Jeopardy. Like, you know, just chewing his gum, you know. Okay. Okay, Melissa, do you have a best guest star? And this could be anybody.
So I don't know if this counts, but it counts. I'm just saying.
Yeah, it is.
So Don Fernando, I believe was his name, from Maria Full of Grace, the guy who told Maria to tell Lucy's sister that she had died. Okay, that guy, like every immigrant neighborhood has a guy like that who knows people, who knows how to get things done, who can find you work even if you don't have papers, who can maybe get you the papers even if they're not completely legal.
Right.
Every immigrant neighborhood has a dude like that. And so it was kind of awesome to see someone like that portrayed like that, because I think that kind of guy has been portrayed before in film and television, but as a like seedy snake oil salesman type. Uh-huh. This guy, you could tell, like most of these guys in real life, genuinely love the people there and just want to help. And they dedicate their lives to doing that kind of work. And a lot of times they don't have like a storefront like he did. Like, you know what I mean? They work out of their house. They go to people's houses. You know what I'm saying? Like, and they live like, you know, by people giving them what they can. They don't have like a regular paycheck or nothing necessarily. So they're not always like legit, like with a storefront and computers and everything, but those people exist. And I think it's kind of awesome because they help establish these immigrant communities that really help our country thrive. And I might be biased because, you know, my family lived in one of those communities. And San Antonio, where I live, is almost one of those communities still, you know what I'm saying? lots of neighborhoods like that here. So yeah, I picked him.
That's a really good pick. That's a perfect guest star, because I mean, I kind of think this is, I don't know, the person they cast for that role, like maybe didn't show up that day. And so they were like, okay, let's just go to the actual one of these guys in the neighborhood. Like, that, like in real life, because he really seemed that way. Like he seemed like a real life guy.
Yeah, he felt very authentic. Yeah.
Okay. Roy picked Burt Reynolds, so I'm not going to pick him. I'm going to go. I'm going to pick Ileana Denise, and that's Shruti.
Mm.
And I kind of picked her as guest because she's Portuguese, or I think she was Indian born, but she's half Portuguese and she has a Portuguese name, and so it's like she's guesting. She's internationally guesting twice in a way.
Okay,
Roy, best external recurring character. So a recurring character that appeared in a different Yours, Mine, and Theirs movie.
Sure. We already pointed one out, I'll leave that to you guys. But I'm going to go ahead and mention from What's Up, Doc?
Yep.
Yeah, we got Hugh from What's Up, Doc.
Hugh from What's Up, Doc. Kenneth Mars is the is the psycho happy doctor.
Yep. Dr. Rollins. Yep.
Dr. Rollins. Okay. Good pick. Okay, Melissa, external recurring character.
I do not have an answer for this.
Okay, that's fine. Well, yeah, you mentioned
earlier the judge from Police Academy, and we have seen Police Academy 4.
Yes, Tackle Barrel. Yes. Yeah,
we've done
Police Academy. Wait, which is 4? Is that Miami or?
Citizens on Patrol.
Cops. Oh, Citizens on Patrol. Yes. Okay.
It's a 0% Rotten Tomatoes movie. That's why we watched it.
We watched it because it was a 0%er. That was our topic.
And what is your percent? Just out of curiosity after watching it.
Police Academy? I mean, probably, I don't know,
number
15%?
Four? Number 4?
Yeah, 12%. I don't know. Well, we watched it with Dream a Little Dream, so it felt a lot better.
It looked Oscar-worthy compared to that.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Okay. My external recurring character is... Okay, honorable mention to protagonist named Murphy.
Mm.
And also honorable mention to Kenneth Mars. But I'm going to go with Kurtwood Smith from RoboCop. Yeah. Because just last time we talked about Ray Wise from RoboCop. We're pretty much just going to recur all the members of Bodiger's gang, I think, eventually.
Okay.
Roy, let's do internal recurring characters. So something that recurred within these three movies.
Sure. So did you know that Burt Reynolds was in all three of these films?
No.
He wasn't. So I went with Pregnancy.
Oh, good. Pregnancy. That's pretty good. Okay.
Yeah. Ray, Pregnancy.
All right. Melissa, do you have all three film recurrence?
I do not.
Okay,
I didn't have time to ponder on it enough. I'm sorry.
No problem.
Oh, it's okay.
Okay, well, you can take mine, and mine is bad wigs.
Okay.
Very good.
I'm mostly thinking of Shruti's wig and Diane's wig in Citizens. Yes. Okay. All right. Melissa, best death?
I mean, Barfy, I guess. I kind of loved how he like took that picture and made that last promise to Shruti before he died. And I kind of love how everybody, the inspector who did look his, I think they did his age makeup pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, like his compared was good. To the others. Yeah. I guess they didn't want to age up the main stars too much or something. Mm-hmm. And that's another scene, by the way, kind of stolen from The Notebook, where, you know, Jamil kind of climbs into bed with him and you're not going to watch it anyway, so I can spoil it, but like, you know, one of the people dies as older in The Notebook, and then the husband climbs into bed with her and he just kind of dies too, you know what I mean? Like, so I felt like that was another homage to The Notebook. But yeah, because it made you cry, but you sort of knew it was coming, and yet it made you cry anyway. Kind of like when I watch Beaches, I already know Barbara Hershey dies. I've seen that movie a million times, and I still want to cry every time. It sucks. And let me just say really quick before I forget, if you don't mind.
Uh-huh.
So you were talking about Kurtwood Smith. He was in a TV show on Amazon Prime Video or whatever it's called now called Patriot a few years back, maybe 5-6 years ago. Okay. That show is highly underrated. It's like a really weird, dark comedy, spy type of thing. And it's weird. And I loved it. And he was in it. And please go see that if you have any spare time. I think it's only like 18 episodes, like the 6 episodes over 3 seasons or for 3 seasons each. So like, you know, it's like 18 episodes or something. They go very quickly. It's a good show.
I commute on a train an hour every day, so I do have time. I'm 2 episodes into Midnight Mass, and And then I'll check it
out. Is that good? That's in my queue, but I haven't seen it yet.
Only two episodes in. It's a slow burner. If you've watched the other two that that director did, it's similar in that it takes its time.
The haunting ones, right? That's the one.
Yeah, the Haunting of Bly Manor and the Haunting of, what was the first one? Was it? I can't remember. Just The Haunting? I don't know.
Oof. Something house. I forget. But I saw that one, yeah. That one was good. I enjoyed
it. Bly Manor one was really good, but if you see that, you should also definitely watch the movie The Innocents, which is just really good.
Okay.
But anyway, yes, I'll check it out. Okay. What were we talking about? Oh, death. Yes. So usually we get to like glorify some sort of gory, spectacular death, but I'm with you. Barfi and Jill Mill having their final moment together in the hospital bed. Just love
it. So nobody picked Ruth's baby?
Oh,
no.
So that's a question, right? Is there a baby that died? So anyway. No, I didn't pick that.
Yeah. That's a little too morbid even for me.
I'm
not saying something because I can be pretty damn morbid.
Nice. Okay, well, I commend you two for picking the Barfi death because it is noble and it's lovely and it's nice. I went with Lucy in the tub.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, wow. Oh,
jeez.
Talk about morbid. Jeez.
Oh, that's the one I remember. That's the death I remember.
She gave her life so that drugs could be smuggled. Yeah. So
that people could get high at a brosive party. Yeah.
Yep. Okay, and this is actually a dumb question. I meant to ask while we were talking about Maria Full of Grace, but is it cocaine in there or is it something else?
I'm assuming that it's cocaine.
I assume it's cocaine just because it's Colombia.
Yeah, that's sort of where I went with it, but
okay.
My thought though was have y'all ever done cocaine? Either of you?
Not that I remember. No.
Okay, I've done quite a bit of it when I was younger, my party days, and I guess if it's too much, maybe you would react like Lucy did, but man, cocaine makes you feel like a million freaking dollars. Yeah. I mean, seriously, it.
Does it smell like poop?
No, it's not like toothpaste. I don't know. Maybe if you have too much in your system, but I was thinking it could have been something else in there, maybe heroin or something. Who knows? I don't know. But because it's Colombia, I mean, that's what we know, right? Mm-hmm. The cocaine, I don't know. They never, I don't think they ever specifically said.
No. Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
All right then. John.
Okay, no problem. Wait, where are we?
Oh, we're villain.
Still, we're on villain. Okay, Roy, what's your villain?
Honorable mention to Barfi's rat tail, which is just almost ruins the whole film.
Yeah.
Right, but I'm gonna go with money. Money is the villain.
You didn't go drugs this time.
Drugs would have been a good choice.
You didn't go.
Are you going with drugs, John?
I'm not going with drugs. Melissa, what are you going with as far as
that? I'm going with Burt Reynolds.
Okay.
With Blaine Gibbons.
Yeah, yes. Blaine Gibbons. He's he's weird. He raised the money. He has his little masseuse boy. It's really weird.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm gonna go with the Rose boss, Maria's Rose boss. Yeah. Who's like doesn't let her go to the bathroom, and then when she throws up in the flowers, he's like, wash these flowers off and then throw these flowers away and then don't go to the bathroom. So it's just it's the villains that go the extra mile that really get to me. Okay, Melissa, best hero.
I'm gonna go with in this case, I think I'm going to go with Ruth. And I know that sounds like a weird choice for a hero.
Interesting.
But she got through the media circus that was no fault of her own. She was just sort of placed there being used by both sides. And she managed to get out of there with some kind of dignity intact and some money. Mm. Yeah, I don't think she probably straightened her life out. It would be nice if she did. But, they leave it open-ended. And I think it's, who you are that determines how you see her future. And I have a deep-seated cynical streak running through me. And I try and tamp her down because she will just ruin everything if I don't. But, I mean, she comes out, especially with movies. And I don't think she probably did a lot of great things with that money. But the fact that she could walk away and leave that circus behind like that, that there's a certain amount of heroism to that, I think.
Well, I think, I'm assuming she went to a small town hardware store, and she probably helped some guy, hardware store owner, pay his rent for that month. For a couple months.
So. We'll see. Yeah, I don't know. I want to... I don't know. I want to believe that, having that cash, like, encourages her, because she's like,
and the
okay,
self-help tapes.
I have all of this, and I have the self-help tapes. If she listens to the tapes, then maybe, yeah, I think that'll be good. Okay, Roy, a hero.
Well, it's just an honest man doing his job, Inspector Dutta.
the Javert of the movie.
Yes.
Okay. I went with Harlan from Citizen Ruth, who pays the $15,000 to even things out, you know. And also, he does free security. He apparently has a lot of money, but, you know, he uses all his time, you know, helping out the cause and the effort. And I was also impressed that he's immune to Ruth's wiles. okay. Let's see. Roy, best goof. Movie goof, if you found a movie goof.
Okay, so Mr. Gupta, in the police station in the 70s, is wearing an Abercrombie & Fitch shirt.
Whoa. That's a goof. Abercrombie & Fitch established 1873.
I was going to say the awful old person wigs, but...
Oh, dang, I already said that. Yeah. Okay, Melissa, do you have a movie goof?
I do not.
Okay. Fair enough. Okay, my goof is, I can't believe they got away with this, but some of the actors in Barfi, even though it's a Hindi movie, sometimes they forgot and started speaking a few words in English.
Oh, like, I looked this up, because I've seen several Indian movies, and like, it's a recurring theme, and I'm like, okay, they're just kind of pandering to an American audience, or maybe like it's cool to speak a little English, but apparently, like...
Well, I'm not surprised.
Well, because India was, you know, a colony for a long time, right?
Right, right.
And so people in India basically grow up simultaneously learning multiple languages. And so they don't, from what I read, they don't even really separate them or think of them as different. They just, when they're speaking, like, they choose the words that best convey what they want to say. And sometimes those words are English instead of Hindi. It's not a movie gimmick. It's real life.
I know it's real life. I know. I was kind of, my joke was... that they're trying really hard not to speak English, but sometimes it's because everybody speaks English unless they're.
Oh, I made you explain your joke. I apologize.
Yeah, you always do that. Why do you always do that? And why are my jokes never very funny?
I'm sorry, John.
Okay. All right. Speaking of jokes, Roy, what's your LOL moment?
Okay. Barfi's taking a shower, and we learn that Barfi is a never nude. Because he's got the cutoff shorts in the shower.
Okay, yeah, he's got the Tobias cutoff shorts. Okay, Melissa, do you have, what's the funniest moment?
Yeah, I know this is going to sound this tickle, because, like, you know how you see a movie several times, like I've seen Barfi, and you're still tickled, but you laugh a little less hard every time, you know. So I'm trying to go off of like the first time I saw it, and to me, the part that made me laugh the most was the horse.
Yes.
Where he contorts himself somehow so that you can't tell that he's hanging on to the other side of this horse. And I don't know why it tickled me so much, but it just did. And it still makes me laugh pretty hard considering how many times I've seen it. So, yeah, I'm going to go with that.
And then the horse turns around, defeating his whole contortion. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. He's hanging on to the horse. Yeah.
No, that's perfect. I'm surprised no one picked the pull my finger and tell me how loud my fart was.
Oh, yeah. And then his dad plays along like this big.
Yeah, like this big. That's pretty great. You know, like a deaf person is into that. Yeah.
Yeah, but you know that for me was more heartwarming and more of a character beat than just a laugh. You know what I mean? Because it really showed you like the relationship between the two of them, and so it was definitely funny. I really did love that. I don't know, the horse for some reason.
Yeah, no, I love. I'm glad you mentioned that because I was going to mention that as an honorable mention, and I haven't picked mine yet. Honorable mentions to pretty much every scene of Maria Full of Grace. I couldn't decide. And then in Citizen Ruth, honorable mention to when Ruth is lying in bed and she's thinking about all the things people yell at her that day, like, you're not going to amount to anything, Ruth. And it's like, well, you know, you can't give this baby up. That's murder. Or, you know, when are you going to get off the huff? And then like the last thing she thinks is something that someone that Dale's manager yells to him. It's just like, okay, what's his name didn't show up. You're going to have to pick the carts up today, Dale. Like, and that's just like some traumatic thing that she remembered while she was lying in bed. But no, the winner is in Citizen Ruth. And Roy, you mentioned this. I thought for sure you're going to pick this. When the newscast says, one thing we do know is Ruth is not speaking. And then in the background of the newscast, you see her jumping on the porch. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
That was a great moment.
Yeah. No, that's great. Okay. Okay. Roy, key of D minor moment. What's the saddest of all moments?
Okay, when Lucy's sister learns the truth.
Oh gosh.
About Lucy being murdered.
Yeah, Lucy. No, that I didn't even consider that because I'm just like, I want to get past this. I just want to skip this scene. I just want to get past it. That's what I was thinking. Okay, Melissa, saddest moment.
I actually picked the same moment. I really did because you knew it was coming, and you knew it was coming soon. Like, how soon, how long could she possibly go without finding out, considering Don Fernando knew? You know what I'm saying? So I just, yeah, because, like, all of a sudden, these two girls who she had a little bit of sympathy for, so much so that she let them sleep on her floor, like, and fed them and everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, look how poor they are, you know, that they can't afford a bigger place, and they're feeding two more mouths just because they mentioned Lucy, not even calling Lucy to fight. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, somebody with that kind of heart, I mean, she just turned so vicious, calling, you know, just like, and rightfully so, by the way. That's not a criticism of her reaction. It's just like she turned so quickly because you could really feel that anger and that sorrow and that regret, you know, all rolled into one. It was a great character moment, really well played by the actress.
Very good. Okay, I went with Barfy, surprisingly. And this was a huge turning point for me, but this is still at the point in the movie when Barfy is madly in love with Shruti, and he goes over, you know, to kind of ask for her hand or to, you know, do some formality, and then he sees her with, you know, her kind of fiancé husband, and then just in, you know, kind of a in frustration, you know, this normally very cool, very, you know, put together guy who's not clumsy at all, on the way out, he walks into the door and he can't get his umbrella open, and then the chain on his bike is gone after, you know, after kind of being rejected by the woman he loves. And then there's like about 45 seconds where he's signing to her, and I don't know what he's saying because he's signing. And I don't think she knows what he's saying either, but it's just, he's just laying it all out, and he's just laying out his frustration in sign language. And I don't know what the words were, but I just got his frustration on that.
Yeah.
So
that was good.
Okay. The what the heck moment, Roy. What the heck happened?
Okay. Honorable mention to the lifesavers pay $2,000 a month in fax fees. I don't like
fax.
How many faxes do you have to send in 1996 to cost $2,000? I don't know. But let's give it to the bloody bathtub.
Yes.
That's got to be it.
Okay, bloody bathtub. Okay. Melissa, the what the heck moment? I think this is the moment that surprised you or took you by the most surprise.
One of them was that Jimmel's father would try to use her to get the money. Like it. The things he did, the way he seemed to have no regard for her, like, comfort or safety or anything. He just wanted that money. Yeah, from the very beginning, like, when he pulled her out of the home, knowing that he was ill-equipped to deal with her needs, really got me. But, and I know this is going to sound funny, but the one I'm going to go with, though, that was more like an honorable mention. So, in Maria Full of Grace, they're talking to Don Fernando. Lucy's sister has already left to go to work. And Beneja Blanca pulls out the drugs from her purse so that everybody could freaking see them. Like, ugh. That made me hate her so bad.
Yeah.
And you know what I'm saying? What an idiot. Like, she just pulled them out so casually looking for something else in her purse. I'm like, lady, like, what are you doing? So I don't know why that made me so mad, like almost viscerally mad at her. I already didn't really care for the character that much, but after that, forget it. Like, I was like, I hate her.
Okay. I'm going to go honorable mention to getting the money from the drug guys. I didn't think that was going to happen. I didn't think the drug guys would be that reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
There is a sequence. There's a part, I think it's when Ruth gets knocked out. She hits her head or something, and it's like full on 10 seconds of black in Citizen Ruth, and I thought my TV was broken because I'm like, oh, I guess she's not waking up. I don't know. But I'm actually going to go with the end of Barfi, just because, like I said, I seriously didn't expect, you know, the love between Barfi and Jill Mill to turn into romantic love like it did. I was just like, even though it makes so much sense in hindsight for me, I just still wasn't anticipating it. Okay, Melissa, best scene of all these.
This was really hard for me, but I guess it's more like a montage than a scene in Barfi, where you see how he's realizing just how much maintenance, I guess you could say, Jimon needs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like she can't have her feet dirty, so he has to wash her feet, and you know, she needs to hang on to something. She can't just walk behind him, so he like offers his pocket turned inside out. You know what I mean? Like, it's like this kind of montage of all the little things he realizes that she needs just to so that she'll keep going and not throw a tantrum or something. And the fact that, I guess this is connected to the fact that later he falls in love with her despite his initial annoyances at her needs, really kind of brought that whole montage home for me later. It made it have more meaning, and I guess you see that more upon second or third viewing than the first, because it's more like in retrospect. So I don't know if that counts, but that's what I'm going with.
Okay. Roy, scene.
Yeah, so in Citizen Ruth, the first time she huffs a bag of paint, that was beautiful. That's not what I'm going with. So from Barfi, just at the very end when they're finally reunited, and I mean, they touch heads and it's really, really sweet, but I think the moment that I really loved was when Jill Mill notices that Shruti is there, and she like stands between Shruti and Barfi, right? Like, you're not taking him, right? I loved it. I thought it was great.
Okay, nice. I think my favorite scene is actually the one I mentioned. It's the key of D minor, which is where Barfi goes off on Shruti in sign language like that. But honorable mention to the swallowing pills scene in Maria Full of Grace and the girls on the plane scene in Maria Full of Grace. Just a lot of tension in those scenes. Okay, Roy, time for acting. Best actor.
Acting, okay. So I'm going to go with Priyanka Chopra Jonas as Jill Mill.
Okay, so, yeah, that's really tough. Quick. I went with Priyanka Chopra Jonas, and it was funny. I don't know about you, but after the movie, first of all, I saw in the credits, I'm like, wait, Jill Mill is played by Priyanka Chopra? That name is familiar. Who is that? You know, and then I looked it up. It's like, oh, it's a Jonas brother wife person. And also she's like a model, you know, because I kind of did the thing where, you know, her facial expressions, like I feel like I've witnessed that, you know, in like autistic people. And, you know, I'm no expert or anything, but, you know, part of me is like, you know, did, you know, is this person, you know, is this person, you know, kind of method acting because, you know, they,
oh
yeah.
Well, to that point, I like halfway through the movie, I'm like, how did they get this autistic person to like cooperate so well? Right. Yeah. And like, and then I saw like the picture of the actress. I'm like, oh my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah, so, no, totally. Yeah. And you can kind of, and so, like, she does these, like, contortions, you know, that seem, like, just so natural. It's some details. Okay, sorry, Melissa, we're just talking about Priyanka Chopra. I wonder if you're going to say the same thing.
I did, yes, okay. Because she's unrecognizable. She really melts into this character. And I'm not an expert either, but as I mentioned earlier, I did spend all my summers in high school working at a camp for kids with disabilities. And we had, you know, Autistic Week. And, yeah, she really nailed it. Like, it's a certain type of, like, a certain point on the spectrum, basically, because not all autistic people are the same. Not even close. You know, I think a lot of people, like, their only real, you know, exposure to that is maybe like Rain Man previously or something, you know what I'm saying? And not all autistic people are like that at all, you know, but she really did kind of nail it. And, also I appreciated that she did it as a woman because, autism affects both genders, but I think we tend to only see men, you know, portrayed with it most of the time. And so it was nice to, you know, because let's face it, people get a lot of their education from entertainment, right? I mentioned this in the other podcast, how, like, in France, the cops, there was a story about the cops being, like, totally exasperated because, you know, the long arm of the Hollywood, entertainment industry, it just, like, reaches all over the world. And cop shows, American cop shows in particular, are quite popular overseas. And so the French police would arrest a suspect and they don't have the same rights. But because they'd watched so much American cop shows and movies, they thought they had the same Miranda rights that Americans do. So they're like, you know, oh, I want a lawyer. I have the right to remain silent. And you actually don't have that right. Not exactly like that in France. And so the cops just don't know what to do because everybody thinks they have American rights that they don't have because they learn from TV. You know what I'm saying? That's our great educator, more than schools in some cases. And so if, you know, to that point, like if you haven't been exposed to any autistic people in real life and you're just going by what you see on TV or film, and you see Rain Man, you're going to have the wrong idea. So for her to have done this and just so well, I'm hoping it's kind of for those who see this, and especially in India where, as she said in the press, autism is not something that's well known there. If this can be educational in any way, that would be great because she really did a fantastic job. But I want to give points to Ranbir Kapoor as well, who played Barfi, because the physical comedy aspect was amazing.
Did you see, oh gosh, I can't remember. It's called like, oh, I don't remember, but I did notice that the same director and the same guy who played Barfi were in a movie. They made another movie a couple years later, and the rating isn't nearly as high. But I was wondering if you saw their collaboration after Barfi as well.
No.
Okay. Yeah, I would be kind of interested because, you know, it's a completely different story, completely different thing. I think he plays like a
space journalist pirate or robot.
Something. Yeah, I can't remember. So, okay. Let's move on. I'm going to skip ahead to, okay, let's go to best quote, best line of the movie. Roy, do you have a line?
I do. So I liked the "we don't really sit in those chairs" line. That's pretty good.
Yes.
But so I'm going to take it from Barfi, and it's Shruti speaks it, and she says, "Sometimes silence is the language of love," and it was just lovely.
Okay. Okay. Okay, Melissa, what do you have?
Yeah, I picked that one too because
we both did.
I think when you like, when you really love someone, when you're really in tune with someone, you can sit there in silence. Yep. And it's not awkward, and you don't worry like, oh God, you know, what is he thinking? Why does he not want to talk to me? You know what I'm saying? Like you can just exist together.
Yep.
And not have to fill all the silence with noise. You know what I'm saying? The silence can be comfortable, but it doesn't mean that like you don't love each other, that you have nothing to say to each other. It's just that you don't need to constantly have conversation, and it's still okay and it's still great. And I've rarely experienced that in my life, but when you do have that, that's a beautiful thing.
That's so interesting you guys both picked that, because I went with her mother's follow-up to that, where she says, "Someday that silence will drown out your love." And, you know, that's just me being negative Nelly or whatever. But I found that really fascinating because she calls her mom out later. She's like, "Mom, you lied to me. You're still in love with that lumberjack. That's why I have to keep seeing him all the time. That's why you drive up and stalk him." And then he looks in the window like, "Huh?" And then you squeal away. But also, I was wondering if her mother had a point in this specific case, because her mom convinced Shruti to not wind up with Barfi. And if that happened, she persuasioned her, yes. And if that happened, then the love story that we see in the movie never would have happened, because Barfi would have been with Shruti. And I'm wondering if there is some point that that Shruti and Barfi, even though they have this sort of superficial romance where they, you know, have their glances at each other and everything, they're not able to communicate in the same way that Barfi and Jilmil do. And I guess we'll never know. I mean, because they did love each other, and so I think they would have made whatever sacrifices it took to make it work. But, you know, but they're still the romance that the movie is not about, and I think the mom had to explain it that way. Yeah. So
it's fascinating though, because Shruti's marriage does descend into silence, but not the kind of silence that Melissa was talking about, right?
Yeah.
Right. It's the silence where there's just nothing to talk about, because it's the bad kind of silence,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so like her mom's dire warning came true anyway with someone that she didn't love, but
see, it's because her mom didn't love her father. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like she was forced into that marriage too much. Like you know, there was a part of me that questioned like whether she wanted that for her daughter because it would make her comfortable, or because she just wanted her daughter to suffer too. Like she wouldn't be able to handle it if her daughter was happy. Like she never got to be in love, That quote came from a deeply cynical place that her mom has in her because of her failed marriage. I mean, not failed as in divorce. Obviously, she would never divorce him, but like failed in terms of there's no love there.
Yeah.
Like that's why her mom said that. Of course, because that's the only experience she's had with love, is that it did drown out everything, you know?
John's heart weren't so cold. you would understand.
If she'd had a better experience or got to be with the lumberjack dude, then, you know, she might have a very different perspective.
I think Shruti is cursed to eternal silence. That's what it sounds like to me.
Wander the earth alone.
Yeah.
Like the Incredible Hulk.
Yeah. So I'm proud of Shruti, but yeah, I just thought, it's too bad it wasn't her story, ultimately. Okay, let's go with titular line. Okay, Melissa, do you have a line where the name of the movie is said in the movie?
I mean, the only one you know, that I could think of off the top of my head when I was trying to figure these out on the way home today, was where Barfi says his name when they explain why that became his nickname, because it's not actually his, like, legal name or anything.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's the one I picked, Barfi saying his own name. Yeah.
Oh, so I went with Jill Mill saying Barfi's name, because you know what it reminded me of, John? It was just like Somewhere in Time.
Richard.
When Jane Seymour yells, Richard! Yeah.
Yes. Okay. All right. Okay, so that is titular line. Okay, are there any questions that we have not responded to?
I have no questions.
Okay, yeah. Melissa, do you have any questions that we haven't answered?
I don't think so.
I have two questions.
It's just always interesting seeing the perspective of other people. And y'all are both very, very different for me. I mean, y'all grew up in Utah, as you know, in the Mormon community. I grew up Catholic in South Texas. I mean, there's just so much obvious differences between us. So it's fascinating to see your perspective of movies that I really enjoyed. So, but I don't know if I have any questions. I'm just, I'm glad I did this.
Nice.
Thank you. Okay. Hey, you have to do it again in 2 weeks.
You do have to do it again. This is the fun one. Next time is going to be the obligatory one. So,
okay.
The real slog.
Yeah. Okay. Really quick, I have a question, and that's why does the New York hotel in Maria Full of Grace, why don't they have any fitted sheets in that hotel?
Well, that's an interesting
because nobody
detail.
Wanted to fold those things.
Yeah, I guess. Okay. Okay. Now taglines. Roy, give us the tagline that won from this poster, and give us your three new taglines, please.
Sure. So my favorite is from Maria Full of Grace,
yes.
Based on 1,000 true stories.
Yes. Good.
I liked it. So my alternates with Citizen Ruth. For my tagline, I've got free can of glossy silver with each ticket. Maria Full of Grace, a young woman's adventure in the Colombian job market. And then for Barfi, love is not a crime like kidnapping. So those are my taglines.
Okay, I thought for sure you'd pick one of my taglines, but that's fine.
Okay. Oh, I'm glad I didn't.
Melissa, do you have a favorite
tagline? I wish I had an answer. I wish I had something clever that I could have sat down and done this, but I did not have the time.
That's totally fine. Sorry, we're doing this a full 24 hours earlier, and I'm running on fumes myself, so I commend everything that you've been able to contribute so far. Okay, I agree with Roy on the best tagline that exists on the posters, based on 1,000 true stories, Maria Full of Grace, so that's pretty good. Okay, my new tagline for Citizen Ruth is, there's very little money in miscarriages. my tagline for Maria Full of Grace is, it's what's inside that counts. By the way, I don't know if anybody noticed that, but at the end of Maria Full of Grace, as she's walking through the airport, there's a sign on the back that's behind her that says, it's what's inside that counts. And so that's why I got that. Okay, and then for the Barfi tagline, I have, life is Barfiful.
Oh, geez.
Okay, quickly.
The Melissa Awards.
The Melissa Awards. Okay, so we have the Melissiest scene, the Melissiest character, and the Melissiest movie. Okay.
Because of how well we know you, Melissa.
Yeah. Okay. what's the Melissiest scene, Roy?
Re-ingesting the pods.
Re-ingesting the pods, okay.
I'm assuming that Melissa's done that before, so...
Just totally. Re-ingested.
Yeah.
not ingested, just the re-ingesting.
I didn't even put the toothpaste on it when I did it.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Okay. Melissa, what would you say for your Melissiest scene?
I would say the scenes where she listens to the tapes. Now, I don't listen to, like, those motivational type things. But it's funny because I called myself a cynic earlier, like I had a deep-seated cynical streak. But there's a part of me that really just doesn't want to be cynical and wants to be hopeful. Not like Pollyanna, rose-colored glasses, but just hopeful, just a little. You know what I'm saying? And you get the sense that she wants to be that person, too, when she listens to those tapes. But she's not. Do you understand?
Yeah.
And so that's how I feel sometimes. Like, I want to believe, I want to have hope, but I don't.
Oh, okay. That's sad yet comforting. Yeah.
I'll do my best to try and kill any hope you have left with my movie pick for next week.
Oh, good. Okay, I picked the Diane reveal. Turns out, I'm a little liberal pro-choice person, and she takes off her wig. That's the,
why? I need an explanation.
Because I was afraid I was afraid you'd ask for an explanation. I think because you're full of surprises. That's the reason. Yeah.
Because you were raised Catholic, but we now suspect that you've taken off your wig.
Yes, your Catholic.
I don't know
wig.
What that means.
Okay.
Roy.
It's because I told you I'm a heathen, right? That's what it is.
Yes.
Sure.
Okay, who's the maliciest character, Roy?
I'm going to go with Cheryl Stoney, with the Stoney's daughter.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
There you go.
Yeah, a little bit of rebellion growing up. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I was very much like that as a teenager. That's a good call.
Yeah. I went with Shruti. I think someone with kind of some ideals of love, but then goes off and maybe does better things than love with her life. So yeah. Sorry, you gasped. I hope that wasn't super offensive.
No, it's not offensive. It's just that I did point out that, like, she never seemed to have her own thing or her own happiness and everything, at least if they showed later in her life, was related to Barfi. But so that part, you know, that was like the one big thing I would change. But I do see what you're talking about. You know, as long as you're not wishing me to, like, pine over some past love for the rest of my life, then I'm okay with
it. I do not wish for that. No, I do not. Okay, but you know yourself. You know yourself. Who's the person you related to the most?
So I don't feel like there's any one character that really, I don't know, that made me, God, no. I think the closest would probably be Lucy's sister, because the way she sort of, like, she didn't have a whole lot, and she didn't, you know, and she was about to welcome a baby in the world, which means that she's going to have even less because there's going to be more mouths to feed more. You know, I mean, babies are expensive, right? And so, like, but she didn't regret it at all, you know, and she made do with what she had, and she seemed pretty happy. Like, she seemed like she, you know, and it didn't matter that by other people's standards or even by conventional American standards that she's, like, below the poverty line and not doesn't seem to be doing well. She was doing her thing, what she wanted, and she seemed pretty happy. And I think, like, if I had a wish for myself, that I would get to that place. And I think I am actually finally, after 45 years, getting there. And so I can kind of relate to her more. But if you would ask me this question, maybe even, like, 2 or 3 years ago, I don't think I would have answered her.
Okay, well, we're all complex individuals, and we all evolve into different on-screen personas that we relate to, so that's fine. Okay, Melissa, don't answer this. Okay, Roy, what's the maliciest?
Now you just make me want to answer it even harder.
Oh, not allowed to. You'll answer this in a minute.
We assume the maliciest movie is also the movie you prefer of the three. So yeah, we just want to anticipate it a little bit more. Roy, what do you think is the maliciest movie?
Oh, I'm guessing it's Barfi.
I'm guessing it's Barfi too. Okay, let's go on to rank these suckers.
Well, so real quick.
Yeah.
Voters. Yeah. Decided that Maria Full of Grace is the best, but it just barely edges out Barfi. Citizen Ruth did get a vote. And I do want to say real quickly, Citizen Ruth cost $3 million. Yes. And it made $285,000.
Oh.
So, you know, yikes a little bit. Maria Full of Grace, $3 million, but it made $12 million. Barfi cost $3 million, and it made $4 million. And then
that's
$4 million
American, I assume.
Yeah. So Rotten Tomato-wise, the winner is Maria Full of Grace with a big old 97. Barfi with an 86. And Citizen Ruth, 81%. So... not bad. But now, here we are. It's us that matter, so here we go.
Okay, Melissa, let's hear, of these three, we know you love these, of course, but of these three, what would you rank number three?
I would probably rank Citizen Ruth as three.
Okay, excellent.
It's still a great movie. I still love it, but, I mean, these are all three movies that I really like, so... you know, I'm splitting hairs a little bit, but I would say that, yeah.
Really quickly, I'm just going to say I had a really hard time, ordering these around. And it's one of my favorite, having a hard time ordering these around because it's actually kind of silly to rank these three next to each other.
They're so different.
Because these movies could be more different. And so it's like, this is our favorite thing right now where we insult these movies by ranking them next to each other when they shouldn't really necessarily be compared. Like, this one's better than this one because they're so different and so unique and so useful in their own ways. So, Roy, that said, what's the worst one of these?
What's the worst one?
Yeah.
Oh, man, the worst one was Citizen Ruth.
So, okay, you both say Citizen
Ruth. It was just...
okay. For my number three pick, I actually went with Maria Full of Grace. It could have used more laughs. That's all I'm saying. Okay.
Drug dealing lends itself to comedy really easily. Yeah. There's a lot of opportunity there.
swinging around, my number two pick is your number three pick, Citizen Ruth. So, Roy, what do you think?
My number two, and honestly, so I saw this movie, and I'm like, well, there's no way this is going to be topped, yeah. But my number two is Maria Full of Grace.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
That's kind of how I thought it would shake out. Okay, so Melissa, I'm dying to hear your number two pick.
Oh, I'm sure they're going to be totally shocked that I picked Maria Full of Grace. Yes.
Yeah, no, it totally makes sense. So you guys are right in step with each other. I just switched my two and three, but... gosh, I can't believe it. I've heard so much about Barfi. I didn't listen to your podcast, and I'm like, how good can Barfi be? And I honestly have some complaints about Barfi, but here's the thing about Barfi. It surprised me where it counts and where it mattered.
I loved it.
So, yeah.
It was a beautiful movie, and it just felt so effortless to enjoy it, right? I don't know. I just really – I loved it. It was great. Thank you, Melissa.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, okay, let's breathe a sigh and indulge in the afterglow of Melissa's movies. And now we're done with that.
Afterglow position seven. Here we go.
Yes. So finishing that. So now, as we said, it's obligation time.
Yeah.
Roy, you have command of understanding how we do this because I always lose track. The listeners for our next podcast, we picked – primary colors, so a red movie, a yellow movie, and a blue movie. Is Blues Brothers still winning in the poll?
Yes, by one vote, Blues Brothers is going to win. So we're watching the Blues Brothers.
We're watching Blues Brothers. Okay, perfect. Okay. And you pick first. You're either going to pick a red movie or a yellow movie, correct?
I'm picking a red one, because if I picked a yellow one, that would only leave you with like two yellow movies to choose from.
Right.
Because we haven't spent nearly enough time watching foreign films, we're doing Raise the Red Lantern, because I just don't know if I'll get another chance to get this movie in.
Raise the Red Lantern is supposed to be really good. Okay,
it is really good. Yeah.
Okay. Now, I have to pick a yellow movie.
You do, sir.
Okay, I was going to pick Thin Yellow Line. I think it's called Thin Yellow Line.
The urine movie?
It's about a couple guys in Mexico who paint lines on the road.
Okay.
But I looked it up just now, and it's not streaming anywhere. It might be just really hard to find. Katie, if you're listening, I know you talked about that movie. I'm sorry I'm not picking it. And I really, really wanted to pick Yellow Hair and the Fortress of Gold, a 1984 movie about a fiery blonde half-breed yellow hair and her easygoing sidekick, the Pecos Kid, after a fortune in Mayan gold. It looks like a 1984 exploitation Indiana Jones ripoff with a, you know, this flighty blonde girl in the lead. And I know it's going to be terrible and offensive. And I wanted to watch it, but I'm like, no, I don't want, I don't want to add this to the podcast. So I went with a movie I'd never heard of called Yellowstone, an old movie.
1936.
It's on Amazon Prime, so it's easy to watch, and it's 85 minutes. So
it's a murder movie.
It's a murder movie. It's it, the tagline is The Great Geyser Mystery.
Oh man.
So
how great does that sound?
It takes place in Yellowstone, I guess, and there's a murder like on by geyser, maybe? I don't know. Someone gets killed by a geyser. That's all I know. So it should be pretty easy to watch though. So we're watching Yellowstone.
All right, good deal. Well, that's awesome. So the next category, so we're not going to be voting on any movies, but in 2 weeks, Brooke is going to hopefully come on and tell us what three movies she's going to pick. And her three movies have to be three movies she has never seen before.
Yes.
So looking forward to that. And then Brooke's community service. So we will be voting on these categories this go around. The random one that was chosen was body swap movies.
Okay.
So like, you know, Freaky Friday, Vice Versa. There's a handful of them.
Right.
And then I'm picking a category, and I'm going to go with the Neighbors from Hell movie. Or, you know, weird neighbors, bad neighbors, funky neighbor movies. So
okay, Neighbors from Hell.
Perfect. Yeah, like, so for some examples, right?
Christmas Vacation.
Christmas Vacation, which we've done, but yeah. Christmas
Oh, you've
Vacation.
Done? Okay.
Yeah, so Rosemary's Baby is an obvious one. Rear Window is an obvious one. Yeah. There's a, you can look it up. If you look up Neighbors from Hell, there's actually a movie called Neighbors from Hell. Movies with bad neighbors is a good way to search it. And there's a handful that look pretty interesting. Anyway, that's my pick. I have a movie in mind that I haven't mentioned, but it's really good. And we'll see if it wins or not.
All right. Well, we'll see if it wins.
John, what do you got?
All right. Well, we kind of talked about it with Ammon last time very briefly. And I'm like, well, maybe I'll bring this up again. And I am nominating I Am Kirok, which is Tommy Kirk movies. Tommy Kirk, of course, the middle brother of Swiss Family Robinson and the kid from Absent-Minded Professor and Son of Flubber, Mars Needs Women, The Monkey's Uncle, The Misadventures of Merlin Jones, that Tommy Kirk, who joined the Disney squad, and then, from what I understand, Disney dumped him when they found out he was gay. That's what I heard. Anyway, Tommy Kirk, you've seen all his movies.
Many of them, probably, yeah. Just from the Disney Channel when I was a kid, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Tommy Kirk movies. Okay, so that's that'll be in our poll shortly. The Body Swap movies, Neighbors from Hell, and Tommy Kirk movies. And you guys will help us decide what Brooke will have to deal with. With for her community service, and that is our future business. And the I guess I'll preview it. Like the big news, also, I think at the end of the next podcast with you, Melissa, we're going to be bringing on our friend Zoe because it is time to reveal the possible Halloween marathon categories.
Yes. Oh, I love scary movies. I love Halloween.
Yes, yes. Okay, yeah. Melissa, help us with Halloween this year. Help us with our movies.
Okay.
Yeah, and we'd love to hear your thoughts. But in the meantime, next week is your obligation, or next 2 weeks is your obligation. So
2 weeks.
Thursday, 2 weeks from now, be near your Skype again, and we'll do this again if you're up for it, if you have the energy.
Yes, sir. I will.
Okay.
Thank
awesome.
You so much, Melissa. It was great having you on.
Yes, it was super fun.
Was
so,
fun.
Yep, we're halfway done. In the meantime, that's it. I have nothing more to say, so I'll just say no more.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Quantum
Leap. That's a lot of pressure on us to help you make up your mind.
Yeah, well.
Can we cuss on this podcast? I'm sorry.
Well, try to refrain from the F word anyway. I think we've had a PG-13 language.
I'll try really hard. I'm a cusser, so it's, and I don't get to cuss at work, obviously. So I've just spent the last 9 hours like not cussing.
Ingrown toenail procedure. I'm like, no, I've got a podcast. She's like, really? Like, you should do a podcast as a doctor. And she's like, oh no, I'd be too tempted to violate doctor-patient confidentiality. Yeah, HIPAA. That's exactly what she said. I'm like, well, that would be hilarious. So.
Today, patient X.